Random House Audio presents The 4-Hour Body, The Secrets and Science of Rapid Body Transformation by Tim Ferriss. Read for you by Zach McLarty. The spring of 2007 was an exciting time for me. My first book, after being turned down by 26 out of 27 publishers, had just hit the New York Times bestseller list and seemed headed for number one on the business list, where it landed several months later. No one was more dumbfounded than me. On one particularly beautiful morning in San Jose, I had my first major media interview, via phone, with Clive Thompson of Wired Magazine. During our pre-interview small chat, I apologized if I sounded buzzed. I was. I had just finished a 10-minute workout as a chaser after a double espresso on an empty stomach. It was a new experiment that would take me to single-digit body fat with two such 10-minute sessions per week. Clive wanted to talk to me about email and websites like Twitter. Before we got started, and as a segue from the workout comment, I joked that the major fears of modern man could be boiled down to two things: too much email and getting fat. Clive laughed and agreed. Then we moved on. The interview went well, but it was this offhand joke that stuck with me. I wrote it down on a piece of paper when we hung up and retold it to dozens of people over the subsequent month. The response was always the same: agreement and nodding. The 4-Hour Body, it seemed, had to be written. The wider world thinks I'm obsessed with time management, but they haven't seen the other, much more legitimate, even ridiculous, obsession. I've recorded almost every workout I've done since age 18. I've had more than 1,000 blood tests performed since 2004, sometimes as often as every 2 weeks, tracking everything from complete lipid panels, insulin, and hemoglobin A1C, to IGF and free testosterone. I've had stem cell growth factors imported from Israel to reverse permanent injuries, and I've flown to rural tea farmers in China to discuss pu'er tea's effects on fat loss. All said and done, I've spent more than $250,000 on testing and tweaking over the last decade. Just as some people have avant-garde furniture or artwork to decorate their homes, I have pulse oximeters, ultrasound machines, and medical devices for measuring everything from galvanic skin response to REM sleep. The kitchen and bathroom look like an ER. If you think that's craziness, you're right, it is. Fortunately, you don't need to be a guinea pig to benefit from one. Hundreds of men and women have tested the techniques in the 4-Hour Body, 4-HB, over the last 2 years, and I've tracked and graphed hundreds of their results. Many have lost more than 20 pounds of fat in the first month of experimentation, and for the vast majority, it's the first time they've ever been able to do so. Why does the 4-HB approach work where others fail? Because the changes are either small or simple, and often both. There is zero room for misunderstanding, and visible results compel you to continue. If results are fast and measurable, self-discipline isn't needed. I can give you every popular diet in 4 lines. Ready? Eat more greens. Eat less saturated fat. Exercise more and burn more calories. Eat more omega-3 fatty acids. We won't be covering any of this. Not because it doesn't work. It does, up to a point. But it's not the type of advice that will make friends greet you with, "What the bleep have you been doing?" whether in the dressing room or on the playing field. That requires an altogether different approach. Let's be clear. I'm neither a doctor nor a PhD. I am a meticulous data cruncher with access to many of the world's best athletes and scientists. This puts me in a rather unusual position. I'm able to pull from disciplines and subcultures that rarely touch one another, test hypotheses using the kind of self-experimentation mainstream practitioners can't condone, though their help behind the scenes is critical, and report results that are easy to reproduce. By challenging basic assumptions, it's possible to stumble upon simple and unusual solutions to long-standing problems. Overfat? Try timed protein and pre-meal vinegar. Undermuscled? Try ginger and sauerkraut. Can't sleep? Try upping your saturated fat or using cold exposure. This audiobook is designed to give you the most important 2.5% of the tools you need for body recomposition and increased performance. Some short history can explain this odd 2.5%.
Vilfredo Pareto was a controversial economist-cum-sociologist who lived from 1848 to 1923. His seminal work, Cours d'économie politique, included a then-little-explored law of income distribution that would later bear his name, Pareto's Law, or the Pareto Distribution. It is more popularly known as the 80-20 principle. Pareto demonstrated a grossly uneven but predictable distribution of wealth in society. 80% of the wealth and income is produced and possessed by 20% of the population. He also showed that this 80-20 principle could be found almost everywhere, not just in economics. 80% of Pareto's garden peas were produced by 20% of the pea pods he had planted, for example. In practice, the 80-20 principle is often much more disproportionate. To be perceived as fluent in conversational Spanish, for example, you need an active vocabulary of approximately 2,500 high-frequency words. This will allow you to comprehend more than 95% of all conversation. To get to 98% comprehension would require at least 5 years of practice instead of 5 months. Doing the math, 2,500 words is a mere 2.5% of the estimated 100,000 words in the Spanish language. This means 2.5% of the total subject matter provides 95% of the desired results. This same 2.5% provides just 3% less benefit than putting in 12 times as much effort. This incredibly valuable 2.5% is the key, the Archimedes lever, for those who want the best results in the least time. The trick, of course, is finding that 2.5%. This audiobook is not intended as a comprehensive treatise on all things related to the human body. My goal is to share what I have found to be the 2.5% that delivers 95% of the results in rapid body redesign and performance enhancement. If you are already at 5% body fat or bench pressing 400 pounds, you are in the top 1% of humans and now in the world of incremental gains. This audiobook is for the other 99% who can experience near unbelievable gains in short periods of time. It is my sincere hope, if you've suffered from dissatisfaction with your body or confusion regarding diet and exercise, that your life will be divided into before 4-HB and after 4-HB. It can help you do what most people would consider superhuman. It all works. There is no high priesthood. There is cause and effect. Welcome to the director's chair. Just a note before we go on. When we reach the exercise portion of the program, Occam's Protocol, I'll direct you to a bonus feature, a PDF file that illustrates in detail how to proceed. My recommendation is this. Listen to the audiobook in its entirety first. Then return to the file, study it, and use it as a guide. There's a lot of great stuff in there to help you shape your 4-hour body. The minimum effective dose. Arthur Jones, the inventor of Nautilus exercise machines, left a number of important legacies, one of which will be the cornerstone of everything we'll discuss, the minimum effective dose. The minimum effective dose, or MED, is defined simply, the smallest dose that will produce a desired outcome. Jones referred to this critical point as the minimum effective load, as he was concerned exclusively with weight-bearing exercise, but we will look at a precise dosing of both exercise and anything you ingest. Anything beyond the MED is wasteful. To boil water, the MED is 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius, at standard air pressure. Boiled is boiled. Higher temperatures will not make it more boiled. Higher temperatures just consume more resources that could be used for something else more productive. If you need 15 minutes in the sun to trigger a melanin response, 15 minutes is your MED for tanning. More than 15 minutes is redundant and will just result in burning and a forced break from the beach. During this forced break from the beach, let's assume 1 week, someone else who heated his natural 15-minute MED will be able to fit in 4 more tanning sessions. He is 4 shades darker, whereas you have returned to your pale pre-beach self. Sad little manatee. In biological systems, exceeding your MED can freeze progress for weeks, even months. In the context of body redesign, there are two fundamental MEDs to keep in mind. To remove stored fat, do the least necessary to trigger a fat loss cascade of specific hormones. To add muscle in small or large quantities, do the least necessary to trigger local, specific muscles, and systemic hormonal growth mechanisms. Knocking over the dominoes that trigger both of these events takes surprisingly little. Don't complicate them. For a given muscle group, like the shoulders, activating the local growth mechanism might require just 80 seconds of tension, using 50 pounds once every 7 days, for example. That stimulus, just like the 212 degrees Fahrenheit for boiling water, is enough to trigger certain prostaglandins, transcription factors, and all manner of complicated biological reactions. What are transcription factors? You don't need to know. In fact, you don't need to understand any of the biology, just as you don't need to understand radiation to use a microwave oven. Press a few buttons in the right order, and you're done. In our context, 80 seconds as a target is all you need to understand. That is the button. More is not better. Indeed, your greatest challenge will be resisting the temptation to do more. The MED not only delivers the most dramatic results, but it does so in the least possible time. Everything popular is wrong. This is clearly a lie. Gaining 34 pounds in 28 days requires a caloric surplus of 4,300 calories per day. So for a guy his size, he must have eaten 7,000 calories a day. He expects me to believe that he dropped 4% in body fat as a result of eating 7,000 calories? I took a big swig of Malbec and read the blog comment again. Ah, the internet. How far we haven't come. It was amusing and just one of hundreds of similar comments on this particular blog post. But the fact remained. I had gained 34 pounds of muscle, lost 4 pounds of fat, and decreased my total cholesterol from 222 to 147, all in 28 days without anabolics or statins like Lipitor. The entire experiment had been recorded by Dr. Peggy Plato, director of the Sports and Fitness Evaluation Program at San Jose State University, who used hydrostatic weighing tanks, medical scales, and tape measures to track everything from waist circumference to body fat percentage. My total time in the gym over 4 weeks? 4 hours. 8 30-minute workouts. The data didn't lie. But isn't weight loss or gain as simple as calories in and calories out? It's attractive in its simplicity, yes, but so is cold fusion. It doesn't work quite as advertised. To do the impossible, you need to unlearn imitation of the popular. How do you do that? By using mental models or analytical rules of thumb. In the world of body redesign, the following mental models, pulled from a variety of disciplines, are what will separate your results from the rest of mankind. Put another way, moving 100 kilograms, 220 pounds, 100 meters, about 27 flights of stairs, requires 100 kilojoules of energy, or 23.9 calories, known to scientists as kilocalories, kcal. A pound of fat contains 4,082 calories. How many calories might running a marathon burn? 2,600 or so. The caloric argument for exercise gets even more depressing. Remember those 107 calories you burned during that kick-ass hour-long Stairmaster session? Don't forget to subtract your basal metabolic rate, BMR, what you would have burned had you been sitting on the couch watching The Simpsons instead. For most people, that's about 100 calories per hour given off as heat, BTU. That hour on the Stairmaster was worth 7 calories. As luck would have it, 3 small stalks of celery are 6 calories, so you have 1 calorie left to spare. But wait a minute, how many calories did that sports drink and big post-workout meal have? Don't forget that you have to burn more calories than you later ingest in larger meals due to increased appetite. For the vast majority of you who weigh more than 120 pounds, 20 pounds of recomposition, which I'll define in a moment, will make you look and feel like a new person. So I suggest this as a goal. If you weigh less than 120 pounds, aim for 10 pounds. Otherwise, 20 pounds is your new specific goal. Even if you have 100 plus pounds to lose, start with 20 as your goal. On a 1 to 10 attractiveness scale, 20 pounds appears to be the critical threshold for going from a 6 to a 9 or a 10, at least as tested with male perceptions of females. The term recomposition is important. It does not mean a 20-pound reduction in weight. It's a 20-pound change in appearance. A 20-pound recomp could entail losing 20 pounds of fat or gaining 20 pounds of muscle. But it most often involves losing 15 pounds of fat and gaining 5 pounds of muscle, or some blend in between. Designing the best physique includes both subtraction and addition. How, then, do we get to 20 pounds? Imagine a ruler with 100 lines on it, representing 100 total units, and two sliders. This allows us to split the 100 units into three areas that total 100. These three areas represent diet, exercise, and drugs. It is possible to reach your 20-pound recomp goal with any combination of the three, but some combinations are better than others. 100% drugs can get you there, for example, but it will produce the most side effects long term. 100% exercise can get you there, but if injuries or circumstances interfere, the return to baseline is fast. Here is the ratio of most of the fat loss case studies I've seen. 60% diet, 10% drugs, 30% exercise. If you're unable to follow a prescribed diet, as is sometimes the case with travel or vegetarianism, you'll need to move the sliders to increase the percentage attention paid to exercise and drugs. For example, 10% diet, 45% drugs, 45% exercise. The numbers need not be measured, but this concept is critical to keep in mind as the world and circumstances interfere with plans. Learning diet and exercise principles is priority number one, as these are the bedrock elements. Relying too much on drugs makes your liver and kidneys unhappy. The percentages will also depend on your personal preferences and adherence, which we'll cover next. Eating at least one head of lettuce per day works well for losing fat and controlling insulin levels if you're a critical intervention patient, such as a morbidly obese type 1 diabetic. The options for such people, as explained by their doctors, are 1. Change your diet with this prescription, or 2. Die. Not surprisingly, adherence is often incredible. For someone who would like to lose 20 pounds but is more interested in how their ass looks in a pair of jeans, however, the adherence will likely be abysmal. Chopping vegetables and cleaning the Cuisinart 3 times per day will lead to one place: abandonment of the method. Does that mean it won't work for some people? No, it will. It just means that it will fail for most people. We want to avoid all methods with a high failure rate, even if you believe you are in the diligent minority. In the beginning, everyone who starts a program believes they're in this minority. Take adherence seriously. Will you actually stick with this change until you hit your goal? If not, find another method, even if it's less effective and less efficient. The decent method you follow is better than the perfect method you quit. Don't confuse physical recreation with exercise. Physical recreation can be many things: baseball, swimming, yoga, rock climbing, tipping cows. The list is endless. Exercise, on the other hand, means performing an MED of precise movements that will produce a target change. That's it. It's next to impossible to draw cause and effect relationships with recreation. There are too many variables. Effective exercise is simple and trackable. Physical recreation is great. I love chasing dogs at the park as much as the next person. Exercise, in our context, however, is the application of measurable stimuli to decrease fat, increase muscle, or increase performance. Recreation is for fun. Exercise is for producing changes. Don't confuse them. Don't confuse correlation with cause and effect. Want to look like a marathon runner, thin and sleek? Train like a marathoner. Want to look like a sprinter, ripped and muscular? Train like a sprinter. Want to look like a basketball player, 6'8"? Train like a basketball player. Hold on now. That doesn't work. Nor does it work for the first two examples. It's flawed logic, once again appealing and tempting in its simplicity. Here are three simple questions we can ask to avoid similar fatal mistakes in thinking. Is it possible that the arrow of causality is reversed? Example: Do people who are ripped and muscular in the first place often choose to be sprinters? Yep. Are we mixing up absence and presence? Example, if the claim is that a no-meat diet extends average lifespan 5 to 15%, is it possible that it is the presence of more vegetables, not the absence of meat, that extends lifespan? It most certainly is. Is it possible that you tested a specific demographic and that other variables are responsible for the difference? Example, if the claim is that yoga improves cardiac health and the experimental group comprises upper-class folk, is it possible that they are therefore more likely than a control group to eat better food? You bet your downward dog-posing ass. The point isn't to speculate about hundreds of possible explanations. The point is to be skeptical, especially of sensationalist headlines. Most studies given media coverage are observational studies and can, at best, establish correlation, A happens while B happens, but not causality. A causes B to happen. If I pick my nose when the Super Bowl cuts to a commercial, did I cause that? This isn't a haiku. It's a summary. Correlation doesn't prove causation. Be skeptical when people tell you that A causes B. They're wrong much more often than they're right. Use the yo-yo. Embrace cycling. Yo-yo dieting gets a bad rap. Instead of beating yourself up, going to the shrink, or eating an entire cheesecake because you ruined your diet with one cookie, allow me to deliver a message. It's normal. Eating more, then less, then more, and so on in a continuous sine wave is an impulse we can leverage to reach our goals faster. Trying to prevent it, attempting to sustain a reduced calorie diet, for example, is when yo-yoing becomes pathological and uncontrollable. Incorporating overeating at specific times, on the other hand, fixes problems instead of creating them. The top bodybuilders in the world understand this, and even when in a pre-contest dieting phase, we'll cycle calories to prevent hormonal downregulation. The daily average might be 4,000 calories per day, but it would be cycled as follows. Monday, 4,000. Tuesday, 4,500. Wednesday, 3,500, etc. You can have your cheesecake and eat it too, as long as you get the timing right. The best part is that these planned ups and downs accelerate rather than reverse progress. Forget balance and embrace cycling. It's a key ingredient in rapid body redesign. Predisposition versus predestination. Don't blame your genes. The marathoners of Kenya are legendary. Kenyan men have won all but one of the last 12 Boston marathons. In the 1988 Olympics, Kenyan men won gold in the 800-meter, 1500-meter, and 5,000-meter races, as well as the 3,000-meter steeplechase. Factoring in their population of approximately 30 million, the statistical likelihood of this happening at an international competition with the scope of the Olympics is about 1 in 1.6 billion. If you've been in the world of exercise science for any period of time, you can guess their muscle fiber composition, which is an inherited trait. Slow twitch. Slow twitch muscle fibers are suited to endurance work. Lucky bastards. But here's the problem. It doesn't appear to be true. Much to the surprise of researchers who conducted muscle biopsies on Kenyan runners, there was a high proportion of fast twitch muscle fibers, the type you'd expect to find in shot putters and sprinters. Why? Because, as it turns out, they often train using low mileage and high intensity. If you are overweight and your parents are overweight, the inclination is to blame genetics. But this is only one possible explanation. Did fatness genes get passed on, or was it overeating behavior? After all, fat people tend to have fat pets. Even if you are predisposed to being overweight, you're not predestined to be fat. Don't accept predisposition. You don't have to, and we can feed and train you toward a different physical future. Nearly all of my personal experiments involve improving something that should be genetically fixed. It is possible to redirect your natural-born genetic profile. From now on, bad genetics can't be your go-to excuse. The Harajuku Moment. The decision to become a complete human. For most of us, the how-to books on our shelves represent a growing to-do list, not advice we followed. Several of the better-known tech CEOs in San Francisco have asked me, at different times, for an identical favor. An index card with bullet point instructions for losing abdominal fat. Each of them made it clear. Just tell me exactly what to do and I'll do it. I gave them all the necessary tactical advice on one 3x5 card, knowing in advance what the outcome would be. The success rate was impressive. 0%. People suck at following advice. Even the most effective people in the world are terrible at it. There are two reasons. Most people have an insufficient reason for action. The pain isn't painful enough. It's a nice to have, not a must have. There has been no Harajuku moment. There are no reminders. No consistent tracking equals no awareness equals no behavioral change. Consistent tracking, even if you have no knowledge of fat loss or exercise, will often beat advice from world-class trainers. But what is this all-important Harajuku moment? It's an epiphany that turns a nice-to-have into a must-have. There is no point in getting started until it happens. It applies to fat loss as much as strength gain, to endurance as much as sex. No matter how many bullet points and recipes I provide, you will need a Harajuku moment to fuel the change itself. Chad Fowler knows this. Chad, CTO of InfoEther Incorporated, spends much of his time solving hard problems for customers in the Ruby computer language. He is also co-organizer of the annual RubyConf and RailsConf conferences, where I first met him. Our second meeting was in Boulder, where he was kind enough to use his natural language experience with Hindi to teach a knuckle-dragger, me, the primitive basics of Ruby. Chad is an incredible teacher, gifted with analogies, but I was distracted by something he'd mentioned in passing. He'd recently lost 70-plus pounds in less than 12 months. It wasn't the amount of weight that I found fascinating. It was the timing. He'd been obese for more than a decade, and the change seemed to come out of nowhere. Upon landing back in San Francisco, I sent him one question via email. What were the tipping points, the moments and insights that led you to lose the 70 pounds? I wanted to know what the defining moment was, the conversation or realization that made him pull the trigger after 10 years of business as usual. His answer is contained in this chapter. Even if you have no interest in fat loss, the key insights, partial completeness, data, and oversimplification among them, are important. Whether you want to lift 500 pounds, run 50 kilometers, gain 50 pounds, or do anything else in this book. But let's talk about one oddity up front, calorie counting. Didn't I just get done thrashing calorie counting? I did. And I'm including Chad's calorie-based approach to prove a point. If you are very overweight, very weak, or very anything negative, tracking even a mediocre variable will help you develop awareness that leads to the right behavioral changes. The 4-hour body didn't exist when Chad lost his weight, and there are far better things to track than calories. But would I recommend tracking calories as an alternative to tracking nothing? You bet. Tracking anything is better than tracking nothing. This underscores an encouraging lesson. You don't have to get it all right. You just have to be crystal clear on a few concepts. Results will follow. The Harajuku moment. Why had I gone 10 years getting more and more out of shape, starting off pretty unhealthy in the first place, only to finally fix it now? I actually remember the exact moment I decided to do something. I was in Tokyo with a group of friends. We all went down to Harajuku to see if we could see some artistically dressed youngsters and also to shop for fabulous clothing, which the area is famous for. A couple of the people with us were pretty fashionable dressers and had some specific things in mind they wanted to buy. After walking into shops several times and leaving without seriously considering buying anything, one of my friends and I gave up and just waited outside while the others continued shopping. We both lamented how unfashionable we were. I then found myself saying the following to him. For me, it doesn't even matter what I wear. I'm not going to look good anyway. I think he agreed with me. I can't remember, but that's not the point. The point was that as I said those words, they hung in the air like when you say something super embarrassing in a loud room but happen to catch the one randomly occurring slice of silence that happens all night long. Everyone looks at you like you're an idiot. But this time, it was me looking at myself critically. I heard myself say those words, and I recognized them not for their content, but for their tone of helplessness. I am, in most of my endeavors, a solidly successful person. I decide I want things to be a certain way, and I make it happen. I've done it with my career, my learning of music, understanding of foreign languages, and basically everything I've tried to do. For a long time, I've known that the key to getting started down the path of being remarkable in anything is to simply act with the intention of being remarkable. If I want a better-than-average career, I can't simply go with the flow and get it. Most people do just that. They wish for an outcome, but make no intention-driven actions toward that outcome. If they would just do something, most people would find that they get some version of the outcome they're looking for. That's been my secret. Stop wishing and start doing. Yet, here I was, talking about arguably the most important part of my life, my health, as if it was something I had no control over. I had been going with the flow for years, wishing for an outcome and waiting to see if it would come. I was the limp, powerless ego I detest in other people. But somehow, as the school nerd who always got picked last for everything, I had allowed not being good at sports or not being fit to enter what I considered to be inherent attributes of myself. The net result is that I was left with an understanding of myself as an incomplete person. And though I had, perhaps, overcompensated for that incompleteness by kicking ass in every other way I could, I was still carrying this powerlessness around with me, and it was very slowly and subtly gnawing away at me from the inside. So while it's true that I wouldn't have looked great in the fancy clothes, the seemingly superficial catalyst that drove me to finally do something wasn't at all superficial. It actually pulled out a deep root that had been, I think, driving an important part of me for basically my entire life. And now I recognize that this is a pattern. In the culture I run in, computer programmers and tech people, this partial completeness is not just common, but maybe even the norm. My life lately has taken on a new focus, digging up those bad roots, the holes I didn't notice in myself, and now I'm filling them one at a time. Once I started the weight loss, the entire process was not only easy, but enjoyable. I started out easy, just paying attention to food and doing relaxed cardio 3 to 4 times a week. This is when I started thinking in terms of making every day just slightly better than the day before. On day one, it was easy. Any exercise was better than what I'd been doing. If you ask the average obese person, if you could work out for 1 year and be considered in shape, would you do it? I'd guess that just about every single one would emphatically say, hell yes. The problem is that for most normal people, there is no clear path from fat to okay in a year. For almost everyone, the path is there and obvious if you know what you're doing, but it's almost impossible to imagine an outcome like that so far in the distance. The number one realization that led me to be able to keep doing it and make the right decisions was to use data. I learned about the basal metabolic rate, BMR, also called resting metabolic rate, and was amazed at how many calories I would have to eat in order to stay the same weight. It was huge. As I started looking at calorie content for food that wasn't obviously bad, I felt like I'd have to just gluttonously eat all day long if I wanted to stay fat. The BMR showed me that, one, it wasn't going to be hard to cut calories, and two, I must have been making big mistakes before in order to consume those calories, not small ones. That's good news. Big mistakes means lots of low-hanging fruit. Next was learning that 4,000 calories equals about a pound of fat. I know that's an oversimplification, but that's okay. Oversimplifying is one of the next things I'll mention as a tool. But if 4,000 is roughly a pound of fat, and my BMR makes it pretty easy to shave off some huge number of calories per day, it suddenly becomes very clear how to lose lots of weight without even doing any exercise. Add in some calculations on how many calories you burn doing, say, 30 minutes of exercise, and you can pretty quickly come up with a formula that looks something like BMR equals 2,900. Actual intake equals 1,800. Deficit from diet equals BMR minus actual intake equals 1,100. Burn from 30 minutes cardio equals 500. Total deficit equals deficit from diet minus burn from 30 minutes cardio equals 1,600. So that's 1,600 calories saved in a day, or almost half a pound of bad weight I could lose in a single day. So for a big round number, I can lose 5 pounds in a week and a half without even working too hard. When you're 50 pounds overweight, getting to 10% of your goal that fast is real. An important thing I alluded to earlier is that all of these numbers are in some ways bullshit. That's okay, and realizing that it was okay was one of the biggest shifts I had to make. When you're 50 to 70 pounds overweight, or I'd say whenever you have a big change to make, worrying about counting calories consumed or burned slightly inaccurately is going to kill you. The fact of the matter is, there are no tools available to normal people which will tell us exactly how much energy we're burning or consuming. But if you're just kinda right, and more important, the numbers are directionally right, you can make a big difference with them. Here's another helpful pseudoscience number. Apparently, 10 pounds of weight loss is roughly a clothing size, XL to L to M. That was a huge motivator. I love donating clothes all year and doing guilt-free shopping. As a nerd, I find myself too easily discouraged by data collection projects where it's difficult or impossible to collect accurate data. Training myself to forget that made all the difference. Added to this knowledge was a basic understanding of how metabolism works. Here are the main things I changed. Breakfast within 30 minutes of waking and 5 to 6 meals a day of roughly 200 calories each. How did I measure the calories? I didn't. I put together an exact meal plan for just 1 week, bought all the ingredients, stuck to it religiously. From that point on, I didn't have to do the hard work anymore. I became aware after just 1 week of roughly how many calories were in a portion of different types of food and just guessed. Again, trying to literally count calories sucks and is demotivating. Setting up a rigid template for a week and then using it as a basic guide is sustainable and fun. Just a few more disconnected tips. I set up a workstation where I could pedal on a recumbent bike while working. I did real work, wrote parts of The Passionate Programmer, played video games, chatted with friends, and watched ridiculous television shows I'd normally be ashamed to be wasting my time on, all while staying in my aerobic zone. I know a lot of creative people who hate exercise because it's boring. I was in that camp too. I'm not anymore. It changes once you get into it. The bike desk was my savior. That mixed with a measurement system. I got a heart rate monitor, HRM, and started using it for everything. I used it while pedaling to make sure that even when I was having fun playing a game, I was doing myself some good. If you know your heart rate zones, easy to find on the internet, the ambiguity non-fitness experts feel with respect to exercise is removed. 30 minutes in your aerobic zone is good exercise and burns fat. Calculate how many calories you burn. A good HRM will do it for you. And the experience is fun and motivating. I started wearing my HRM when I was doing things like annoying chores around the house. You can clean house fast and burn serious fat. That's not some Montel Williams BS. It's real. Because of the constant use of an HRM, I was able to combine fun and exercise or annoying chores and exercise, making all of it more rewarding and way less likely I'd get lazy and decide not to do it. Building muscle is, as you know, one of the best ways to burn fat. But geeks don't know how to build muscle. And, as I've mentioned, geeks don't like to do things they don't know are going to work. We like data. We value expertise. So I hired a trainer to teach me what to do. I think I could have let go of the trainer after a few sessions, since I had learned the right exercises, but I've stayed with her for the past year. Finally, as a friend said of my difficulty in writing about my insights for weight loss, a key insight is my lack of specific insights. To some extent, the answer is just diet and exercise. There were no gimmicks. I used data we all have access to and just trusted biology to work its magic. I gave it a trial of 20 days or so and lost a significant amount of weight. Even better, I started waking up thinking about exercising because I felt good. It was easy. It was easy for Chad because of his Harajuku moment. It worked because he used numbers. Ground Zero. I used to have a signature move while driving. About a quarter mile or so before arriving at my hard-fought destination, often within 200 feet, I would come to the unwavering conclusion that I'd gone too far. Then I would U-turn and drive in the opposite direction, only to repeat the drill like a dog tethered to a clothesline. Best-case scenario, this shuttle run doubled my travel time. Worst-case scenario, I got so frustrated that I abandoned the trip altogether. This is exactly what most people do with fat loss and exercise. Using a blunt instrument like a scale, the equivalent of the odometer in my example, people often conclude they're not making progress when, in fact, they are making tremendous progress. This leads to a musical chairs of fad diets and demoralizing last-ditch efforts that do more harm than good. To hit your target 20-pound recomposition, you'll need to track the right numbers. The scale is one tool, and you should use it, but it is not king. It can mislead. Take this unedited feedback from Angel, who was 2 weeks into the slow-carb diet at the time. After my cheat day on Saturday, I gained 1 pound, which is normal for me. Week two, I lost that 1 pound. I didn't lose any additional weight on week two, but I'm not discouraged. I did manage to lose in inches. I lost half an inch off my hips, which is absolutely great. I lost a total of 1 inch off my thighs. Not so shabby either. So that's a total of 1.5 inches for the week. I'll take the inches. The grand total of inches lost from day one, 5 inches. Yippee! No exercise either. My driving issues ended when I bought a GPS device. Did it fix my problem because it was accurate? Because I could actually use it to predict how long it would take me to get from point A to point B? Not at all. The GPS fixed my problem because it could answer the simple question, was I getting closer to my destination? The real truth of progress in body redesign, or lack thereof, lies in body composition, not weight. How much of you is useful muscle, and how much of you is useless fat? Our constant companions will be circumference and body fat measurements. Circumference is easy enough. Use a tape measure. We'll cover the sights soon. But how do we actually measure body fat percentage? It turns out there are a lot of options, and the most common are the worst. In one 24-hour period, I took more than a dozen body fat measurements using the easiest to find as well as the most sophisticated equipment available. Here are some of the results, from lowest to highest. 7%, 3-point with slim guide calipers. 7.1 to 9.4%, AccuMeasure. 9.5%, Bodymetrics Ultrasound. 11.3%, DEXA. 13.3%, BODPOD. 14.7 to 15.4%, Omron Handheld Bioimpedance, second value after drinking 2 liters of water in 5 minutes. 15.46 to 16.51%, Foresight Slim Guide Calipers. The range is 7% to 16.51%. So then, which of these bad boys is accurate? The truth is, none of them are accurate, and it doesn't matter. We just need to make sure that the method we choose is consistent. Here are critical points to consider when taking measurements. Number one, never compare before and after results from different tools. Results from different tools cannot be compared. In my 24-hour measurement marathon, I tested 13.3% with BODPOD and 11.3% with DEXA. Let's say I had tested using only DEXA at 11.3% and then tested on BODPOD for my follow-up, which resulted in 12.3%. I would wrongly conclude that I'd gained 1% body fat, whereas I would have seen a more accurate 1% loss had I used BODPOD for both. Number two, if you choose to use bioelectrical impedance, BEI, you need consistent hydration. Using bioimpedance devices, I have been able to make my body fat percentage jump almost 1% in 5 minutes by drinking 2 liters of water in between measurements. Here's a simple approach that largely fixes hydration issues. Immediately upon waking, drink 1.5 liters, about 50 fluid ounces, of cold water. Ensure that water temperature is the same day to day, and wait 30 minutes. Urinate and then test body fat using bioimpedance. Do not eat or drink anything else before testing. I use 2 empty Boulet bourbon bottles, 750 milliliters times 2 equals 1.5 liters, because I love the old school bottles. But Nalgene bottles are generally 1 liter each and have line measurements on the side. Wine and most liquor is also standardized for a 750 milliliter bottle size. Number 3. If you choose to use calipers, you need a consistent algorithm. Even with the same calipers, using different math equals different results. I suggest asking the gym or trainer to use a 3-point or 7-point Jackson Pollock algorithm. This should be as simple as selecting from a drop-down menu in their software. Starting a body recomposition program without measurements is like planning a trip without a start address. I guarantee you will regret it later. Don't fly blind. My father, who lost more than 70 pounds and more than tripled his strength, is still kicking himself for not having body fat numbers. Drop a dime or two and get your data. If need be, skip a few lattes and the dinner out. Next steps. Take your before circumference measurements. Get a simple tape measure and measure 4 locations. Both upper arms, mid bicep, waist, horizontal at navel, hips at widest point below waist, and both legs, mid-thigh. Total these numbers to arrive at your total inches, TI. Changes in this total will be meaningful enough to track. Choose the best tool and schedule a session. If you're over 30% body fat, avoid calipers and use DEXA, BODPOD, or ultrasound in that order. If you cannot find these, opt for bioimpedance and follow the hydration rules mentioned earlier. If you are under 25%, still aim for DEXA, BODPOD, or ultrasound. If you cannot find these, opt for calipers with a qualified professional. Use the same person for all follow-up visits. And request the 3-point or 7-point Jackson Pollock algorithm. If neither is available, use another algorithm that includes a leg measurement and at least 3 points total. Leg fat is tricky and needs to be included. Record the name of the algorithm used for future reference. From photos to fear. Making failure impossible. I love SkyMall magazines. One fateful Tuesday, though, despite my best efforts to read about poolside hammocks and wall-sized maps, I couldn't concentrate. There was a battle being waged across the aisle on Frontier Airlines, and I had a front-row seat. In stunned silence, I watched a man, so obese that he needed a belt extension to buckle himself in, eat a full bag of Twizzlers prior to takeoff. He then proceeded to eat a full bag of Oreos, which he polished off before we had reached cruising altitude. It was an impressive display. I recall asking myself, how can he rationalize eating so much? He had a cane, for God's sake. The answer was, of course, that he couldn't. I doubt he'd even tried. There was no logical justification for his behavior, but then again, there is no logical justification for how I hit the snooze button every 10 minutes for an hour or two every Saturday. We break commitments to ourselves with embarrassing regularity. How can someone trying to lose weight binge on an entire pint of ice cream before bed? How can even the most disciplined of executives fail to make 30 minutes of time per week for exercise? How can someone whose marriage depends on quitting smoking pick up a cigarette? Simple. Logic fails. If you were to summarize the last 100 years of behavioral psychology in 2 words, that would be it. But knowing this, it is possible to engineer compliance. Pulling from both new and often neglected data, including photographic research and auctions, there are 4 principles of failure-proofing behavior. Think of them as insurance against the weaknesses of human nature. Your weaknesses, my weaknesses, our weaknesses. Make it conscious. Make it a game. Make it competitive. Make it small and temporary. Number 1. Make it conscious. Flashing and before photos. The fastest way to correct a behavior is to be aware of it in real time, not after the fact. The curious case of the so-called flash diet is a prime example of the difference. Dr. Lydia Zepeda and David Deal of the University of Wisconsin-Madison enlisted 43 subjects to photograph all of their meals or snacks prior to eating. Unlike food diaries, which require time-consuming entries often written long after eating, the photographs acted as a simple and instantaneous intervention and forced people to consider their choices before the damage was done. In the words of one participant, "I was less likely to have a jumbo bag of M&Ms. It curbed my choices. It didn't alter them completely, but who wants to take a photo of a jumbo bag of M&Ms?" The researchers concluded that photographs are more effective than written food diaries. This is saying something, as prior studies had confirmed that subjects who use food diaries lose 3 times as much weight as those who don't. The upshot? Use your camera phone to take a snapshot before opening your mouth. Even without a prescribed diet, this newfound awareness alone will result in fat loss. The camera can also be used to accentuate your flaws to your benefit. If we analyze the post-contest submissions of the winners of the Body for Life Challenge, the largest physique transformation contest in the last 50 years of publishing, we can isolate one common understated element: before photographs. The training methods and diet varied, but those who experienced the most dramatic changes credited the before photographs with adherence to the program. The pictures were placed in an unavoidable spot, often on the refrigerator, and served as inoculation against self-sabotage. Get an accurate picture of your baseline. It will look worse than you expect. This need not be bad news. Ignoring it won't fix it, so capture it and use it. Number 2. Make it a game. Jack Stack and the stickiness of 5 sessions. Jack Stack was nervous. It was 1983, and he had just joined his employees to purchase SRC, a near-bankrupt engine remanufacturer, from their parent company, International Harvester. It was done in remarkable fashion, with $100,000 applied to a loan of $9 million for a debt ratio of 89 to 1. The bank officer who handled the loan was fired within hours of approving it. The 13 managers who contributed their life savings to make it possible were also nervous, but they needn't have been. That $100,000 would be worth $23 million in 1993, just 10 years later. By 2008, sales had increased from $16 million to more than $400 million, and stock value had risen from 10 cents per share to $234 per share. How? Games. Frequent games. Jack Stack taught all of his employees how to read the financial statements, open the books, and put numerical goals alongside individual performance numbers on grease boards around the plant. Daily goals and public accountability were combined with daily rewards and public recognition. The Hawthorne plant of the Western Electric Company in Cicero, Illinois, also figured this out, albeit accidentally. The year was 1955, and their finding was significant. Increasing lighting in the plant made workers more productive. Then someone pointed out, I have to imagine a sweaty-palmed intern, a confusing detail. Productivity also improved when they dimmed the lighting. In fact, making any change at all seemed to result in increased productivity. It turned out that, with each change, the workers suspected they were being observed and therefore worked harder. This phenomenon, also called the observer effect, came to be known as the Hawthorne effect. Reinforced by research and game design, Jack Stack and Western Electric's results can be condensed into a simple equation. Measurement equals motivation. Seeing progress in changing numbers makes the repetitive fascinating and creates a positive feedback loop. To reiterate, the act of measuring is often more important than what you measure. To quote the industrial statistician George Box, "Every model is wrong, but some are useful." It's critical that you measure something. But that begets the question, to replace self-discipline, how often do you need to record things? That is, how many times do you need to log data to get hooked and never stop? In the experience of the brilliant Nike Plus team,
And in the experience of their users, more than 1.2 million runners who have tracked more than 130 million miles, that magic number is 5. If someone uploads only a couple of runs to the site, they might just be trying it out. But once they hit 5 runs, they're massively more likely to keep running and uploading data. At 5 runs, they've gotten hooked on what their data tells them about themselves. Aristotle had it right, but he was missing a number. We are what we do repeatedly. A mere 5 times, 5 workouts, 5 meals, 5 of whatever we want will be our goal. When in doubt, take 5 will be our rule. Number 3. Make it competitive. Fear of loss and the benefits of comparison. Would you work harder to earn $100 or to avoid losing $100? If research from the Center for Experimental Social Science at New York University is any indication, fear of loss is the winner. Their 3-group experiment looked like this. The first group received $15 and was told the $15 would be taken back if they lost the subsequent auction. The second group was told they'd be given $15 if they won the auction. And the third group was a control with no incentive. The first group routinely overbid the most. Participating economist Eric Schotter explained the results. Economists typically attribute excessive bidding to risk aversion or the joy of winning. What we found is that the actual cause of overbidding is a fear of losing, a completely new theory from past investigations. This is not a depressing realization. It's a useful one. Knowing that potential loss is a greater motivator than potential reward, we can set you up for success by including a tangible risk of public failure. Real weight loss numbers support this. Examining random 500-person samples from the 300,000-plus users of Daily Burn, a diet and exercise tracking website, those who compete against their peers in challenges lose an average of 5.9 pounds more than those who do not compete. There is another phenomenon that makes groups an ideal environment for change: social comparison theory. In plain English, it means that in a group, some people will do worse than you. Sarah lost only 1 pound. Good for me. And others will do better. Mike's nothing special. If he can do it, so can I. Seeing inferior performers makes you proud of even minor progress, and superior performers in your peer group make greater results seem achievable. Looking at Daily Burn's data set, those who have 3 or more motivators in their peer group lose an average of 5.8 pounds more than those with fewer. Embrace peer pressure. It's not just for kids. Number 4. Make it small and temporary. That brings us to your most important next steps. Before you move on, take, or in the case of 2, start, at least 2 of the following 4 actions. Your choice. Do I really look like that in underwear? Take digital photos of yourself from the front, back, and side. Lace your fingers behind your head and wear either underwear or a bathing suit. Not eager to ask a neighbor for a favor? Use a camera with a timer or a computer webcam like the Mac EyeSight. Put the least flattering before photo somewhere you will see it often: the refrigerator, bathroom mirror, dog's forehead, etc. 1. Do I really eat that? Use a digital camera or camera phone to take photographs of everything you eat for 3 to 5 days, preferably including at least 1 weekend day. For sizing, put your hand next to each item or plate in the photographs. For maximum effect, put these photos online for others to see. 2. Who can I get to do this with me? Find at least 1 person to engage in friendly competition using either total inches, TI, or body fat percentage. Weight is a poor substitute, but another option. Use competitive drive, guilt, and fear of humiliation to your advantage. Embrace the stick. The carrot is overrated. 3. How do I measure up? Get a simple tape measure and measure 5 locations: both upper arms, mid-bicep, waist, horizontal at navel, hips, widest point between navel and legs, and both legs, mid-thigh. Total these numbers to arrive at your total inches, TI. I'm telling you again because I know you didn't do it after the last chapter.
get off your ass and get her done. It takes 5 minutes. 4. What is the smallest meaningful change I can make? Make it small. Small is achievable. For now, this means getting started on at least 2 of the 4 steps I've just described before moving on. The rest and best is yet to come. Subtracting fat. The slow-carb diet 1. It is possible to lose 20 pounds of body fat in 30 days by optimizing any of 3 factors: exercise, diet, or a drug supplement regimen. 20 pounds for most people means moving down at least 2 clothing sizes, whether that's going from a size 14 dress to a size 10, or from an XXL shirt to a large. The waist and hips show an even more dramatic reduction in circumference. By April 6, 2007, as an example, I had cut from nearly 180 pounds to 165 pounds in 6 weeks, while adding about 10 pounds of muscle, which means I lost approximately 25 pounds of fat. The changes aren't subtle. The diet that I'll introduce in this chapter, the slow-carb diet, is the only diet, besides the rather extreme cyclical ketogenic diet, CKD, that has produced veins across my abdomen, which is the last place I lose fat. There are just 5 simple rules to follow. Rule number 1. Avoid white carbohydrates. Avoid any carbohydrate that is or can be white. The following foods are prohibited, except for within 60 minutes of finishing a resistance training workout like those described in the Occam's Protocol chapters. All bread, rice, including brown, cereal, potatoes, pasta, tortillas, and fried food with breading. If you avoid eating the aforementioned foods and anything else white, you'll be safe. Just for fun, another reason to avoid the whiteies: chlorine dioxide, one of the chemicals used to bleach flour, even if later made brown again, a common trick, combines with residual protein in most of these foods to form alloxin. Researchers use alloxin in lab rats to induce diabetes. That's right, it's used to produce diabetes. This is bad news for you if you're eating anything white or enriched. Don't eat white stuff unless you want to get fatter. Rule number 2. Eat the same few meals over and over again. The most successful dieters, regardless of whether their goal is muscle gain or fat loss, eat the same few meals over and over again. There are 47,000 products in the average U.S. grocery store, but only a handful of them won't make you fat. Mix and match from the following list, constructing each meal with 1 pick from each of the 3 groups. Here are the choices that produce the fastest fat loss for me. Proteins that include egg whites with 1 to 2 whole eggs for flavor, or, if organic, 2 to 5 whole eggs including yolks. Chicken breast or thigh. Beef, preferably grass-fed. Fish. Pork. Legumes that include lentils, also called dal or dal. Black beans. Pinto beans, red beans, soybeans. And finally, vegetables that include spinach, mixed vegetables, including broccoli, cauliflower, or any other cruciferous vegetables, sauerkraut, kimchi, full explanation of these later in damage control, asparagus, peas, broccoli, green beans. Eat as much as you like of these food items, but remember, keep it simple. Pick 3 or 4 meals and repeat them. Almost all restaurants can give you a salad or vegetables in place of French fries, potatoes, or rice. Surprisingly, I have found Mexican food, after swapping out rice for vegetables, to be one of the cuisines most conducive to the slow-carb diet. If you have to pay an extra $1 to $3 to substitute at a restaurant, consider it your 6-pack tax, the nominal fee you will pay for becoming leaner. Most people who go on low-carbohydrate diets complain of low energy and quit, not because such diets can't work, but because they consume insufficient calories. A half cup of rice is 300 calories, whereas a half cup of spinach is 15 calories. Vegetables are not calorically dense, so it is critical that you add legumes for caloric load. Eating more frequently than 4 times per day might be helpful on higher carb diets to prevent gorging,
but it's not necessary with the ingredients we're using. Eating more frequent meals also appears to have no enhancing effect on resting metabolic rate, despite claims to the contrary. Frequent meals can be used in some circumstances, but not for this reason. The following meal schedule is based on a late sleep schedule, as I'm a night owl who gives up the ghost at 2 a.m. at the earliest, usually with wine glass or book still in hand, a la heroin addict. It's a good look if you can pull it off. Adjust your meals to fit your schedule, but make sure to have your first meal within an hour of waking. Meals are approximately 4 hours apart. 10 a.m., breakfast. 2 p.m., lunch. 6:30 p.m., smaller second lunch. 8 to 9 p.m., recreation or sports training. 10 p.m., dinner. 12 a.m., glass of red wine and Discovery Channel before bed. Here are some of my meals that recur again and again. Breakfast, home. Scrambled Eggology pourable egg whites with one whole egg, black beans, and mixed vegetables warmed up or cooked in a microwave using Pyrex containers. Lunch, Mexican restaurant. Grass-fed organic beef, pinto beans, mixed vegetables, and extra guacamole. Dinner, home. Grass-fed organic beef from Trader Joe's, lentils, and mixed vegetables. Just remember, this diet is, first and foremost, intended to be effective, not fun. It can be fun with a few tweaks, but that's not the goal. Rule number 3, don't drink calories. Drink massive quantities of water, and as much unsweetened tea, coffee, with no more than 2 tablespoons of cream, I suggest using cinnamon instead, or other no-calorie, low-calorie beverages as you'd like. Do not drink milk, including soy milk, normal soft drinks, or fruit juice. Limit diet soft drinks to no more than 16 ounces per day if you can, as the aspartame can both stimulate weight gain and cause vicious headaches. I'm a wine fanatic, and I have 1 to 2 glasses of red wine almost every evening. It doesn't appear to have any negative impact on my rate of fat loss. Red wine is by no means required for this diet to work, but it's 100% allowed, unlike white wines and beer, both which should be avoided. Up to 2 glasses of red wine per night, no more. Rule number 4, don't eat fruit. Humans don't need fruit 6 days a week, and they certainly don't need it year-round. If your ancestors were from Europe, for example, how much fruit did they eat in the winter 500 years ago? Think they had Florida oranges in December? Not a chance, but you're still here, so the lineage somehow survived. The only exceptions to the no-fruit rule are tomatoes and avocados, and the latter should be eaten in moderation, no more than 1 cup or 1 meal per day. Otherwise, just say no to fruit and its principal sugar, fructose, which is converted to glycerol phosphate more efficiently than almost all other carbohydrates. Glycerol phosphate forms triglycerides via the liver, which forms fat storage. There are a few biochemical exceptions to this, but avoiding fruit 6 days per week is the most reliable policy. But what's this 6 days a week business? I thought you'd never ask. It's the 7th day that allows you, if you so desire, to eat peach crepes and banana bread until you go into a coma. Rule number 5. Take 1 day off per week. I recommend Saturdays as your dieter's gone wild, DGW day. I am allowed to eat whatever I want on Saturdays, and I go out of my way to eat ice cream, Snickers, Take 5, and all of my other vices in excess. If I drank beer, I'd have a few pints of Paulaner Hefeweizen. I make myself a little sick each Saturday and don't want to look at any junk for the rest of the week. Paradoxically, dramatically spiking caloric intake in this way once per week increases fat loss by ensuring that your metabolic rate, thyroid function and conversion of T4 to T3, etc., doesn't downshift from extended caloric restriction. That's right. Eating pure crap can help you lose fat. Welcome to utopia. There are no limits or boundaries during this day of gluttonous enjoyment. There is absolutely no calorie counting on this diet, on this day or any other. Start the diet at least 5 days before your designated cheat day. If you choose Saturday, for example, I would suggest starting your diet on a Monday. When you feel mired in details or confused by the latest and greatest contradictory advice, all you need to remember is, rule number one, avoid white carbohydrates or anything that can be white. Rule number two, eat the same few meals over and over again. Rule number three, don't drink calories. Rule number four, don't eat fruit. Rule number five, take one day off per week and go nuts. The Slow Carb Diet 2. The finer points and common questions. How can I possibly follow this diet? It's too strict. Most people vastly overestimate the variety of their meals. Assuming you're not traveling, what have you had to eat for breakfast for the last week? Lunch? Chances are good that especially for breakfast, you've repeated 1 to 3 meals. Rotating 5 or 6 meals for a few weeks is not hard at all, even though you might imagine otherwise. Feeling awesome and looking better each successive week easily justifies having good but familiar food from Sunday to Friday. Saturday is a no-holds-barred. Should I take any supplements? I suggest potassium, magnesium, and calcium. This diet will cause you to lose excess water, and these electrolytes can go along with it. Potassium can be consumed during meals by using a potassium-enriched salt, like light salt, or, my preference, eating extra guacamole with Mexican meals. Avocados, the main ingredient in guacamole, contain 60% more potassium than bananas. Avocados also contain 75% insoluble fiber, which will help keep you regular. If you prefer pills, 99 milligram tablets with meals will do the trick. Magnesium and calcium are easiest to consume in pill form, and 500 milligrams of magnesium taken prior to bed will also improve sleep. If you prefer to get all electrolytes through whole foods, here are good slow-carb options, in descending order of concentration. Notice that spinach is the only item on all three lists. Potassium, 4,700 milligrams per day recommended for an average, healthy 25-year-old male. 1. Lima beans, at the top of the list. 2. Chard. 3. Halibut. 4. Spinach. 5. Pinto beans. 6. Lentils. 7. Salmon. 8. Black beans. 9. Sardines. 10. Mushrooms. Calcium. 1,000 milligrams per day recommended for an average healthy 25-year-old male. 1. Salmon with bones at the top of the list. 2. Sardines with bones. 3. Mackerel, canned. 4. Tofu. 5. Collards. 6. Spinach. 7. Black-eyed peas. 8. Turnip greens. 9. Tempeh. 10. Agar. Magnesium, 400 milligrams per day recommended for an average healthy 25-year-old male. 1. Pumpkin seeds at the top of the list. 2. Watermelon seeds. 3. Peanuts. 4. Halibut, cooked. 5. Almonds. 6. Spinach. 7. Soybeans. 8. Cashews. 9. Pine nuts. 10. Brazil nuts. No dairy? Really? Doesn't milk have a low glycemic index? It's true that milk has a low glycemic index, GI, and a low glycemic load, GL. For the latter, whole milk clocks in at an attractive 27. Unfortunately, milk products paradoxically have a high insulinemic response on the insulinemic index, II or ININ, scale. Researchers from Lund University in Sweden have examined this surprising finding. Despite low glycemic indexes of 15 to 30, all of the milk products produced high insulinemic indexes of 90 to 98, which were not significantly different from the insulinemic index of the reference bread, generally white bread. Conclusions? Milk products appear insulinotropic as judged from 3-fold to 6-fold higher insulinemic indexes than expected from the corresponding glycemic indexes. Removing even a little dairy can dramatically accelerate fat loss. Need something to flavor your coffee? If you must, use cream, not milk, but no more than 2 tablespoons. I opt for a few dashes of cinnamon and the occasional drops of vanilla extract. No fruit? Don't I need a balanced diet? No.
To begin with, there is no consensus on what a balanced diet is. My researchers and I tried to find an official definition from the U.S. Department of Agriculture or other federal agencies, and we could not. I have not seen any evidence to suggest that fruits are necessary more than once a week on cheat day. God, I effing hate beans. Can I substitute something else? Perhaps you just hate farting and not beans. First, let's fix that bean issue. Then I'll talk about how and when you can omit them. Lentils seldom cause the gas problem and are my default in the legume category. For beans, purchasing organic will often fix the rumbling pants effect. And if that doesn't work, soaking the beans in water for a few minutes will help break down the offending cause. Oligosaccharides. This is one of many reasons I eat canned beans and lentils, disposing of the murky juice in the can and rinsing, instead of purchasing either dry. If all else fails, add some Beano, beanzyme for you vegans, or Epizode, available at Mexican grocery stores or online, to the beans, and you're set. Is it not gas, but the blandness that's the problem? That's even easier to fix. Add a little balsamic vinegar and garlic powder. I personally love hot sauce. www.cholula.com is my current favorite. Try red beans instead of black or pinto. If you absolutely must, sprinkle on a small amount, emphasis on small, of Parmesan cheese. Do you really have to eat beans every meal? No, which leads up to the rules of omission. I do not eat beans with every meal because I eat out almost every lunch and dinner. If I'm cooking, lentils and black beans are my defaults. Outside, I'll order extra protein and vegetables for the entree and supplement with one or two slow-carb appetizers, such as unbreaded calamari and a salad with olive oil and vinegar. If you omit legumes in a meal, you must absolutely make a concerted effort to eat larger portions than your former high-carb self. Remember that you're getting fewer calories per cubic inch. Eat more than you're accustomed to. Holy Festivus, I gained 8 pounds after my cheat day. Did I undo all of my progress? No, not at all. It's common for even a 120-pound female to gain up to 8 pounds of water weight after 24 hours of increased carbohydrate intake. Larger males can gain 10 to 20 pounds. Expect massive weight fluctuations after cheat day. Relax. It's just water and will disappear over the next 48 hours. Weigh yourself before eating on your cheat day and ignore the short-term fluctuations, which do not reflect fat loss or gain. Remember to take circumference measurements on your weigh-in days, as it is typical to gain some lean muscle while on this diet. The mitochondria in muscle increase your ability to oxidize fat, so we want to encourage this, but the muscle gain can keep you at the same weight for 1 to 2 weeks. Pounds can lie, but measurements don't. Enjoy your cheat day guilt-free. Can I use spices, salt, or light sauces? What can I use for cooking? Spices and herbs, but not cream-based sauces, are your friends. Take a trip to Whole Foods with $50 and get educated. That $50 spree will last you at least a few months. Montreal steak rub, thick salsa without sugar added, garlic salt, white truffle sea salt. Combine this with tarragon on eggs. Thai chili paste. This is a list of all-star flavor. For salad dressing, a few drops of non-sugar sweetener like stevia mixed with vinegar and mustard will give you a dressing to satisfy any sweet tooth. My preference, and my go-to restaurant salad dressing, is simply balsamic vinegar and olive oil. Butter is fine as long as the only ingredients are butter and salt. For cooking, you can use olive oil for low heat and either grapeseed oil or macadamia oil for high-temperature cooking. Can I drink alcohol? What types of wine are best? On cheat days, all is fair. Have a keg by yourself if the spirit moves you. On diet days, stick to dry wines, dry being defined as less than 1.4% residual sugar. The driest red varietals are Pinot Noir, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Merlot, whereas the driest whites are generally Sauvignon Blanc and Albarino. This certainly doesn't stop me from enjoying my favorite big reds, Malbec from Argentina and Zinfandel from California. I have found better fat loss results with red wine compared to white. Though there are exceptions, it's best to avoid Riesling, White Zinfandel, and Champagne. What should I eat for snacks? There should be no need or real physical urge to eat a lot of snacks. If you are hungry, you're not eating enough protein and legumes at each meal. This is an uber-common novice screw-up. I've been there, too. Eat more. If you're eating enough and still feel the urge to snack, it's a psychological addiction, one that most often goes hand-in-hand with procrastination. Some of us go to the bathroom, others go to the water cooler, and others eat. I've done all three, so I know the drill. If all else fails and you must have a snack, go for carrots. But a bag of carrots will hit you like a donkey kick in the stomach, so don't binge. If I snack, I'll most often make a small snack, 200 to 300 calories, out of restaurant leftovers like Thai chicken basil with no rice. If you're really starving, just eat another slow-carb meal. It won't do any harm. If you get headaches or have other symptoms of low blood sugar, 90% of the time it will be because you are not eating enough. First-time slow carbers are accustomed to eating small portions of calorically dense carbohydrates. Think bagels or pasta. And they duplicate the portion sizes with a calorically lighter slow-carb foods, resulting in insufficient calories. Expect that you can eat 2 to 3 times as much volume and assume that you should. Likewise, if you have trouble sleeping due to hunger, you're not eating enough. In these cases, consume a bit of protein prior to bed, which can be as simple as 1 to 2 tablespoons of almond butter, ideal, or peanut butter with no additives. The only ingredients should be peanuts and perhaps salt. Note, especially to ladies for whom peanut butter seems to be like crack, the tablespoon scoop should be no more than a small mound, not half a jar balanced on a spoon. Do I really have to binge once a week? It is important to spike caloric intake once per week. This causes a host of hormonal changes that improve fat loss, from increasing CAMP and GMP to improving conversion of the T4 thyroid hormone to the more active T3. Everyone binges eventually on a diet, and it's better to schedule it ahead of time to limit the duration and damage. The psychological benefits outweigh even the hormonal and metabolic benefits. I eat like this all the time and have for 7 years. Few ways of eating, WOE, are this sustainable and beneficial. Can you get away with one cheat meal per week? Most men can. Some women can't. Menstruation can stop if leptin levels get too low. This happened to one reader for 7 months until she returned to refeeding, as she called it, binge day, though she only did it once every 2 weeks. Forced overfeeding can temporarily increase circulating leptin 40%. I still suggest once per week as a default. Bumping up food intake for 12 to 24 hours, not necessarily to the point of sickness, is an important reset. If you gain too much or plateau and get nervous, eat a good high-protein meal for breakfast on your off day, and then binge from lunch to dinner, which is what I now do most of the time. I don't always splurge to the point of sickness. In a response to one slow carber, I explained, "Yes, you can eat anything you want in any quantity on Saturdays. I tend to go nuts every 1 of 4 weeks and eat so much I get nearly sick, which makes me moderate the other three. I love Snickers, Tim Tams, Bear Claws, and all pastries, and ice cream. Enjoy." One more tip. Whenever possible, eat out for your cheat meals. No matter what, throw out all bad food before the next morning. If there is bad food in your house, you will eventually eat it before your off day, also called reverse Lent by some followers. What about breakfast? My most frequent breakfast consists of eggs, lentils, and spinach. I prefer lentils straight out of the can to black beans. Breakfast is the hardest meal for most to modify, as we're a country of toast and cereal-eating junkies. Moving to slow carbs and protein requires a more lunch-like meal for breakfast. This is easier when you realize that breakfast can be a smaller meal when followed by a lunch 3 to 5 hours later. Try it for 5 days and you'll see the difference. Not only will the increased protein intake decrease water retention, resting metabolism increases about 20% if your breakfast calories are at least 30% protein. If you want a more typical breakfast, try eggs with turkey bacon or organic normal bacon and sliced tomato. Delicious. Cottage cheese, my mother's preference, is also a fine addition. Do I have to limit veggies to those listed? There's no need to limit veggies to those I listed, but I've found that the more variety you attempt, the more likely you are to quit, as everything from shopping to cleanup becomes more complicated. As I've said before, this diet is not designed to be fun, even though most people end up enjoying it. It's designed to be effective. The vegetables I've listed are those I've found to be the most tolerable when eating them again and again. Feel free to substitute whatever you want, but don't forget to include legumes for calories. One veggie that often gets unnecessarily tossed due to rule number one, no white foods, is cauliflower. Eat all the cauliflower you like. It's great for making faux mashed potatoes. Otherwise, stick to the no white rule. Are canned foods all right? Canned foods are absolutely fine, no problem. Almost all of my vegetables are either frozen, 80%, or canned, 20%. I'm a huge fan of canned tuna in water mixed with lentils and chopped onions. Can I eat whole grains or steel-cut oats? No. Can I do this if I'm a lacto-ovo vegetarian? Lacto-ovo is fine. Meat isn't necessary, but it does make the job easier. Eggs and beans are sufficient to lose weight, and I would avoid most milk products regardless. Cottage cheese is an exception. It doesn't interrupt things, and the high casein content appears to facilitate fat loss. Can I eat salsa? Salsa is outstanding, especially chunky, medium, spicy salsa with corn, beans, etc. I can't stand egg whites by themselves, as they're too boring even for me. This is why I almost always eat whole eggs, but if you add a few spoonfuls of salsa on top of either option, it's a delicious little meal. Just don't put the salsa and lentils in the same bowl. The mixture will make you gag like a cat coughing up a hairball. Fried foods? Stir fry is ideal for this diet, as are most cuisines, like Thai, that depend on it. Deep frying should be avoided because of the breading and poor nutrient density for the calories. Refried beans work just fine, and more than 30 slow carbers have lost up to 1 pound per day using them as a staple. Reader David C. lost 20 pounds in 30 days using almost exclusively canned refried beans. In his last update, he'd lost 42 pounds, and his wife had lost 36 pounds. Refried beans do, however, contain a boatload of sodium, approximately 45% of the daily allowance per cup. If you don't have hypertension, this probably won't kill you, but do your best to include other beans or mix them together on occasion. This will result in less water retention and looking better. Bloated ain't pretty, no matter how low your body fat. I love refried beans, but try to diversify once you have the hang of the diet. What if I'm traveling and eating in airports? If you're airport hopping and cannot find a Mexican restaurant or grill, grab a bag of raw almonds or walnuts at a kiosk and commit to consuming no starch for the remainder of your travel time. There are more than enough calories in that single bag to give you 2 to 3 small meals and get you through a full 12 hours. Most airports also have chicken salads, omit dressings beside olive oil and vinegar, that you can combine with the nuts. If it comes down to it, choose mild hunger instead of deviation. If you always eat on the clock, perhaps it's been a few years since you felt real hunger. Having followed this diet in 30-plus countries, I can state, without exception, that travel is not a legitimate excuse for breaking the rules. Isn't higher protein hard on the kidneys? What if I have gout? First, I am not a doctor, nor do I play one on the internet. If you have medical conditions of any type, consult a physician. Now, on to my interpretation of the data. If you don't have a serious pre-existing medical condition, the amount of protein I prescribe should not hurt you. There is no compelling evidence to support the protein hurts your kidneys claim. This is what Michael Eads, MD, calls a vampire myth, because it just refuses to die despite a lack of evidence. Gout? Gout is usually blamed on purines and therefore protein, so those diagnosed with it like my mother, will be put on low-protein, low-legume diets. I ascribe to Gary Taubes' interpretation of the scientific literature, which indicates that fructose, and therefore sucrose, table sugar, and other factors are more likely to be causal agents of gout. Phosphoric acid in carbonated drinks is also one to avoid. My mother's uric acid levels normalized on the slow-carb diet, despite much higher protein intake. She continued to take low-dose allopurinol during the diet, and the food was the only variable that changed. This said, no matter what you do with your diet or self-experimentation, do not stop or modify medication without consulting a medical professional. I'm hitting a plateau. What should I do? The first three mistakes I'm about to discuss, eating too late, not eating enough protein, drinking too little water, are the most common causes. Nevertheless, the total percentage of body fat lost per month naturally decreases over time. The number of mitochondria in your muscle tissue largely determines your rate of sustained fat loss. Targeted exercise, even just 20 minutes per week, will often double fat loss that's plateaued, and should do so for at least 2 to 4 months. Common mistakes and misunderstandings. The first three mistakes in this section cover 90% plus of stalling problems, but the rest are well worth listening to. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and, in this case, a few minutes of education is worth many pounds of extra fat loss. Mistake number one, not eating within 1 hour of waking, preferably within 30 minutes. Skip breakfast, forget to eat within 1 hour of waking, and you will fail. Mistake number two, not eating enough protein. Get at least 20 grams of protein per meal. This is absolutely most critical at breakfast. Eating at least 40% of your breakfast calories as protein will decrease carb impulses and promote a negative fat balance. Even 20% protein, more than most people consume, doesn't cut it. First choice, down 2 to 3 whole eggs at breakfast. Second choice, if that's impossible to stomach, add other protein-rich whole foods, such as turkey bacon, organic sausages, or cottage cheese. Third choice, have a 30-gram protein shake with ice and water, as my father did. The first few days, you'll feel like you're force-feeding yourself, and then it will all change, and you'll feel incredible. Get at least 20 grams of protein per meal, no matter what. Related problem. Not eating enough food. Do not try to restrict portions or calories. Eat until you are full, and eat as much as you like of the approved foods. If you don't, you will either downshift your metabolism or cheat between meals with banned food snacks. Mistake number three, not drinking enough water. To ensure optimal liver function for fat loss, increased hydration is a requirement. Insufficient water intake, I just don't like drinking much water, seems to be particularly common among women. My mother plateaued in fat loss, and looking at her water intake, I insisted she add a few more glasses. She immediately started losing fat again and lost 3 pounds in the subsequent week. Make a special effort to drink more water on your cheat day, as the carbohydrate overload will pull water to your digestive tract and muscle glycogen from elsewhere. If you don't get enough water, headaches will be the result. Mistake number four, believing that you'll cook, especially if you're a bachelor. In a sentence, if you don't normally cook, get canned and frozen food for the first few weeks. Don't buy a bunch of food that requires cooking skills if you don't have them. Don't buy foods that'll spoil if you've never prepared a proper meal. Unfounded optimism will just result in rotten food and frustration. Keep it simple. If you're preparing food for yourself, use frozen and canned stuff for at least the first 2 weeks. Change one habit at a time. Food selection first, food preparation second. Mistake number five, mistiming weighings with the menstrual cycle. Not a problem for bachelors. Women tend to retain much more water just before their periods or during the week preceding menstruation, if on birth control. Be sure to take this into account when you start your diet and take measurements. Ignore scale readings in the 10 days before menstruation. They're not at all a reflection of what's happening. If you are following the diet to the letter, you will lose fat. Treat your first weighing following your period, as soon as one day following is fine, as your after measurement. Don't let short-term water fluctuation discourage you. Be aware of your menstrual timing so you don't mistakenly conclude the diet isn't working. Mistake number 6. Overeating domino foods. Nuts, chickpeas, garbanzo beans, hummus, peanuts, macadamias. There are certain foods that, while technically fine to eat on the diet, are prone to portion abuse. I call these domino foods, as eating one portion often creates a domino effect of over-snacking. My fat loss has plateaued 3 times due to almonds, which are easy to consume by the handful and simple to excuse as nutritious. Unfortunately, they also contain 824 calories per cup, 146 calories more than a Whopper from Burger King, 678 kilocalories. A few almonds is just fine, 5 to 10. But no one eats just a few almonds. Don't eat anything that requires portion control. Get Domino Foods out of the house and out of reach. Mistake number 7. Overconsuming artificial, or all-natural, sweeteners. Even with no calories, most artificial and natural sugar substitutes provoke increased insulin release, though aspartame, NutraSweet, shows surprisingly little effect on insulin. Not that this is a free license to overconsume NutraSweet. It's often paired with the Cecil Fame K, which has a host of negative health effects. Both low-calorie and no-calorie sweeteners have been associated with weight gain. I've seen just about all of them stall fat loss. Skip the sweeteners whenever possible. If it's really sweet, it probably spikes insulin or screws up your metabolism. Experiment with spices and extracts, like cinnamon and vanilla, instead. Mistake number 8. Hitting the gym too often. There is no need to spend 12 hours in the gym. 1 hour a week is almost always more than enough to reach your recomposition goals. Doing too much will not only not help, it will reverse your progress. Remember the MED. The Lost Art of Binging. Sitting down for Thanksgiving dinner or butter cookies at Christmas? Sounds like a binge. That, in and of itself, doesn't need to mean horrible guilt and extra fat rolls afterwards. If you plan for overdoing it and understand a little science, it's possible to minimize the damage. I eat whatever I want every Saturday, and I follow specific steps to minimize fat gain during this overfeeding. In basic terms, our goal is simple: to have as much of the crap ingested either go into muscle tissue or out of the body unabsorbed. I do this by focusing on 3 principles. Principle number 1. Minimize the release of insulin, a storage hormone. Insulin release is minimized by blunting sharp jumps in blood sugar. Ensure that your first meal of the day is not a binge meal. Make it high in protein, at least 30 grams, and insoluble fiber. Legumes will handle this. The protein will decrease your appetite for the remainder of the binge and prevent total self-destruction. The fiber will be important later to prevent diarrhea. In total, this can be a smallish meal of 300 to 500 calories. Consume a small quantity of fructose, fruit sugar, in grapefruit juice before the second meal, which is the first crap meal. Even small fructose dosing has an impressive near-flatlining effect on blood glucose. I could consume this at the first meal, but I prefer to combine the naringin and grapefruit juice with coffee, as it extends the effects of caffeine. Use supplements that increase insulin sensitivity. AGG, part of PAGG, and PAGG, which I'll explain soon. I usually dose only twice. If I'm going whole hog, I'll have another PAGG dose upon waking. This reduces the amount of insulin the pancreas releases in spite of mild or severe glucose surges. Think of it as insurance. Consume citric juices, whether lime juice squeezed into water, lemon juice on food, or a beverage like citrus kombucha. Principle number 2. Increase the speed of gastric emptying, or how quickly food exits the stomach. Binging is a rare circumstance where I want the food, or some of it, to pass through my gastrointestinal tract so quickly that its constituent parts aren't absorbed well. I accomplish this primarily through caffeine and yerba mate tea, which includes the additional stimulants theobromine, found in dark chocolate, and theophylline, found in green tea. I consume 100 to 200 milligrams of caffeine, or 16 ounces of cooled yerba mate, at the most crap-laden meals. My favorite green supplements, Athletic Greens, doesn't contain caffeine, but will also help. Does this really work, taking the goodies from taste buds to toilet without much storage in between? More than a few people have told me it's pure science fiction. Too much information, TMI, warning. I disagree, and for good reason. Rather than debate meta-studies, I simply weighed my poo. Identical volumes of food on and off the protocol. On protocol equals much more poo mass, same consistency, hence the importance of fiber, equals less absorption, equals fewer chocolate croissants that take up permanent residence on my abs. Simple but effective? Perhaps. Good to leave out of first date conversation? Definitely. But I digress. On to one of the cooler aspects of this whole craziness. GLUT4. Principle number 3, engage in brief muscular contraction throughout the binge. For muscular contractions, my default options are air squats, wall presses, tricep extensions against a wall, and chest pulls with an elastic band, as all three are portable and can be done without causing muscle trauma that screws up training. The latter two can be performed by anyone, even those who have difficulty walking. But why the hell would you want to do 60 to 90 seconds of funny exercises a few minutes before you eat, and, ideally, again, about 90 minutes afterward? Short answer, because it brings glucose transporter type 4, GLUT4, to the surface of muscle cells, opening more gates for the calories to flow into. The more muscular gates we have open before insulin triggers the same GLUT4 on the surface of fat cells, the more we can put in our muscle versus our fat. Long answer, GLUT4 has been studied most intensely for the last 15 years or so, as it became clear around 1995 that exercise and insulin appear to activate, translocate, GLUT4 through different but overlapping signaling pathways. This was exciting to me, as it meant it might be possible to use exercise to beat meal-induced insulin release to the punch, to preemptively flip the switch on the biological train tracks so that food, glucose, is preferentially siphoned to muscle tissue. But how much contraction is enough? It turns out, at least with animals, that much less muscular contraction is needed than was once thought. In one fascinating Japanese study with rats, high-intensity intermittent exercise, HIT, 20-second sprints times 14 sets with 10 seconds of rest between sets, was compared to low-intensity prolonged exercise, LIT, 6 hours of extended exercise, over 8 days. The surprising result? Compared to a control, GLUT4 content in the muscle was increased 83% with 280 seconds of HIT, versus 91% with 6 hours of LIT. Now, of course, animal models don't always have a direct transfer to humans. But I wondered, what if 280 seconds was all it took? This thought produced even more questions. Do we have to get the 280 seconds all at once, or can they be spread out? Is 280 seconds really the magic number, or could even fewer seconds trigger the same effect? Is it even plausible that 60 to 90 seconds of moderate contractions could have a meaningful impact? To attempt to answer these questions, I contacted researcher after researcher on three continents, including GLUT4 specialists at the Muscle Biology Laboratory at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. The short answer was, it did appear plausible. The most important research insight came from Dr. Gregory D. Carty and Katsuhiko Funai. The insulin-independent effects of exercise begins to reverse minutes after exercise cessation, with most or all of the increase lost within 1 to 4 hours. A much more persistent effect is improved insulin sensitivity that is often found approximately 2 to 4 hours and as long as 1 to 2 days after acute exercise. I started with 60 to 120 seconds total of air squats and wall tricep extensions immediately prior to eating main courses. For additional effect, I later tested doing another 60 to 90 seconds approximately 1.5 hours after finishing the main courses, when I expected blood glucose to be highest based on experiments with glucometers. Exercises are best done in a restroom stall and not at the table. If you can't leave the table, get good at isometric, without moving, contraction of your legs. Try to look casual instead of constipated. It takes some practice. In all cases, if you do 60 to 90 seconds of contraction after each meal, and a bit before ideally, you might live to see your abs. Don't forget the air squats. The Four Horsemen of Fat Loss, PAGG. Summer 2007, Northern California. The smoke wisped into the air amid the sounds of summer eating. Laughter, beer bottles clinking, and the undeniable sizzle of tri-tip steak on 3 enormous outdoor grills. All was well in Willow Glen, San Jose, where my parents were visiting me from out of town. I was at home, but they had ventured out to explore downtown Lincoln Avenue on a beautiful afternoon, which led them to La Via Italian Restaurant. My father was standing on the corner admiring the grill work when a thin homeless man sauntered up to his side. After a minute or two of silence and staring at meat and tongs, the homeless man made this opening. "You know how I lost all my weight? More than 100 pounds?" My dad was 5'6" and almost 250 pounds at the time. Silence followed for several seconds, and my father, amused by the approach and more than a bit curious, finally relented. "How?" "Garlic. Clove after clove. It's that simple." The homeless man didn't want anything and never asked for anything. He was earnest. After sharing his advice, he just walked away. As unusual as this encounter was, I had, in fact, been looking at garlic for some time. This was just the final anecdotal push I needed to begin experimenting at much, much higher doses. The homeless man's contribution to my latest cocktail made it all come together. The feedback from one guinea pig, a semi-professional athlete with approximately 9% body fat at 200 pounds, was representative. "I've lost 6 pounds of fat in the last week. This is unfreaking believable." Allicin, one component of garlic, appeared to be the missing fourth ingredient in a supplement stack I'd been refining for 2 years. PAGG. Before, ECA. From 1995 to 2000, I experimented with a fat loss cocktail that comprised ephedrine hydrochloride, caffeine, and aspirin, the famed and research-proven ECA stack. This was the mixture I used 3 times per day when on the cyclical ketogenic diet to produce veins on my abdomen for the first time in my life, all in less than 8 weeks. Ephedrine hydrochloride, 20 milligrams, caffeine, 200 milligrams, aspirin, 85 milligrams. The biochemistry was spot on, and dozens of studies supported the effects. If E equals 1, C equals 1, and A equals 1, the three combined have a synergistic effect of 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 6 minus 10. Sadly, the ECA stack is not a free ride. The effects are beautiful and predictable, but there are prices to be paid. Side effects. Tolerance to the upper-like effects develops quickly, and cessation can cause severe headaches. The withdrawal pains lead to a domino effect of stimulant use. Either people never stop taking ECA, or they substitute in equally strong drugs to avoid chronic fatigue. I suspect there is an entire generation of strength and endurance athletes with ECA-induced adrenal fatigue who now depend on stimulants for normal everyday function. Some, I know, opt for 6 to 10 double espressos per 24 hours. Used in high doses or in high humidity, high heat conditions, ephedrine and ephedra have both been associated with heart attack and death. I suffered so many sinus infections post-ECA that I visited a Stanford-trained specialist who, after reviewing a cranial MRI, asked, without a second of hesitation, "Do you drink much caffeine or take other stimulants?" Almost all of my sinal cavities were completely blocked with compressed, dried matter. She was amazed that I was able to get out of bed in the morning. From that point onward, I removed stimulants for brief but increasing periods, as painful as it was, until I had reestablished basic adrenal function. It was clear that another fat loss approach was needed, something more sustainable. I wanted to find a non-stimulant stack that used different pathways altogether. After, PAGG. The end result was PAGG. Polycosinol, 20 to 25 milligrams, alpha-lipoic acid, 100 to 300 milligrams. I take 300 milligrams with each meal, but some people experience acid reflux symptoms with more than 100 milligrams. Green tea flavanols, decaffeinated with at least 325 milligrams EGCG, 325 milligrams. Garlic extract, 200 milligrams. Daily PAGG intake is timed before meals and bed, which produces a schedule like this. Prior to breakfast, AGG. Prior to lunch, AGG. Prior to dinner, AGG. Prior to bed, PAGG. AGG is simply PAGG minus polycosinol. This dosing schedule is followed 6 days a week. Take 1 day off each week and 1 week off every 2 months. Let's look at our new cast of characters. Polycosinol. Polycosinol, an extract of plant waxes, often sugarcane, is the most controversial element in the PAGG stack. I originally experimented with polycosinol at low and high doses to increase HDL cholesterol and decrease LDL cholesterol. Used in combination with time-release niacin, one orange before bed, and chromium polynicotinate, not picolinate, during the 4-week Geek to Freak project detailed in later chapters. I lowered my total cholesterol from 222 to 147 while almost doubling HDL. There was a pleasant side effect, an unintended but significant reduction in body fat. I isolated the polycosinol over several weeks of further testing. The research studies are far from conclusive regarding polycosinol's effects on cholesterol. Most show no effect whatsoever. This could be due to not dosing polycosinol before peak cholesterol production between midnight and 4 a.m. Regardless, the addition of polycosinol, 10 to 25 milligrams before bed, to the PAGG, then AGG stack, produces, in my experience and those of my guinea pigs, far superior effects for fat loss versus AGG alone. This was tested with 3 brands and 3 dosages, 10, 23, and 40 milligrams per day. I found 23 milligrams per day to be optimal for fat loss, with little additional benefit from higher doses. Alpha-lipoic acid, ALA. Alpha-lipoic acid, ALA, is a potent antioxidant and free radical scavenger that has been proven to regenerate vitamin C and vitamin A, restore levels of intracellular glutathione, an important antioxidant that declines with age, and increase excretion of toxic heavy metals such as mercury. It was first synthesized and tested in the 1970s for the treatment of chronic liver diseases. The intravenous interventions reversed disease in 75 out of 79 subjects. Given its impressive effects, the most remarkable feature of ALA is its apparent lack of toxicity in humans. Its NOAEL, no observable adverse effect level, is 60 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, which would make up to 4,091 milligrams per day safe for a 150-pound person. Our dosing will be 300 to 900 milligrams total per day. Though lipoic acid naturally occurs in some organ meats and vegetables, including spinach and broccoli, the amounts are trace. I didn't want to consume 10 tons of liver for 30 milligrams of lipoic acid, so I began using synthetic alpha-lipoic acid in 1995. In one sentence, here's why alpha-lipoic acid is kick-ass for our purposes. ALA helps you store the carbohydrates you eat in muscle or in your liver as opposed to in fat. green tea flavanols, EGCG. Epigallocatechin gallate, EGCG, is a catechin and flavanol found in green teas. It has been researched for a wide range of applications, including decreasing the risk of UV-induced skin damage, inhibiting cancer growth, and reducing mitochondrial oxidative stress, anti-aging. I tested green tea and EGCG once again for the unreported off-label benefits, specifically two related to body recomposition. Much like ALA, EGCG increases GLUT4 recruitment to the surface of skeletal muscle cells. Of equal interest, it inhibits GLUT4 recruitment in fat cells. In other words, it inhibits the storage of excess carbohydrates as body fat and preferentially diverts them to muscle cells. EGCG appears to increase programmed cell death, apoptosis, in mature fat cells. This means that these hard-to-kill bastards commit suicide. The ease with which people regain fat is due to a certain fat memory. The size of fat cells decreases, but not the number, which makes ECGC a fascinating candidate for preventing the horrible rebounding most dieters experience. Human studies have shown some potential fat loss with as little as a single dose of 150 milligrams of EGCG, but we will target 325 milligrams 3 to 4 times per day, as the fat loss results seem to hockey stick, go from a mild incline to a sharp rise, between 900 and 1100 milligrams per day for the 150 to 200 pound subjects I've worked with. I suggest decaffeinated green tea extract pills as the source, unless you want to be stuck to the ceiling and feel ill. Using tea leaves and steeping cup after cup is too imprecise and too caffeinated. If you are undergoing cancer treatment, please consult your doctor before using EGCG, as it can increase the effects of some drugs, the estrogen antagonist tamoxifen, for example, while decreasing the effects of others, such as the drug Velcade, to which it binds. If you are undergoing treatment for multiple myeloma or mantle cell lymphoma, likewise avoid EGCG. Garlic extract, allicin potential, S-allyl, cysteine. Garlic extract and its constituent parts have been used for applications ranging from cholesterol management to inhibiting lethal MRSA staph infections. Strangely, test subjects and I had the best fat loss results with extracts designed to deliver relatively high doses of allicin. Allicin, if delivered in stable form, appears to have the ability to inhibit fat regain. The reason our results were strange relates to the stable form bit. Most research indicates that allicin should have almost zero bioavailability more than 6 days after extraction from garlic cloves, particularly after exposure to stomach acid. Our confounding results could be due to a combination of other organic components, most notably one precursor to allicin, S-allyl-cysteine, allin. S-allyl-cysteine exhibits outstanding oral bioavailability, near 100% in large mammals. Until further research concludes otherwise, I suggest using an aged garlic extract, AGE, with high allicin potential that includes all constituent parts, including S-allyl-cysteine. I've tried consuming it fresh, chomping on cloves, and it isn't kind to your digestive tract. If you are going the whole food route, use it in your cooking to prevent stomach self-destruction. For precision and convenience, I use supplements to reach my target baseline in dosing, and I use extra garlic in food for delectable but not necessary insurance above that baseline. Warnings. Ensure adequate consumption of B-complex vitamins while using PAGG and consult your doctor before use if you have a medical condition. For example, hypertension, hypoglycemia, diabetes, or are taking any medications. In particular, blood-thinning medications, for example, warfarin, aspirin, etc., thyroid medications, or anti-anxiety drugs like clozapine. If you are pregnant or breastfeeding, do not use PAGG. Blood-thinning compounds ain't for babies. Ice Age. Mastering temperature to manipulate weight. Michael Phelps eats 12,000 calories a day. That was all Ray Cronise heard from across the room. He jerked his eyes up from the spreadsheet and reached for the TiVo to pause the television. 12,000 calories. Ray Cronise had been a high-ranking material scientist at NASA for almost 15 years, and his specialties included biophysics and analytical chemistry. He'd been in mission operations and seen, hell, help produce research the public wouldn't see for decades. But spending half his life in a lab behind a computer had taken its toll. The creeping 2 to 4 pounds per year had added up and left him weighing 230 pounds at 5'9". It was a much-improved 209-pound Ray Cronise who now sat with a spreadsheet in front of him and his eyes on the paused television. He still had more than 30 pounds to lose, but at his current rate, a respectable one, it would take at least 18 to 24 weeks. The spreadsheet was designed to fix this by comparing column after column of all the human activities he could isolate, each correlated to its caloric expenditure per hour for his weight. He was tired of being fat and hoped the numbers would provide a faster solution. Instead, they painted a futile picture. Even if he ran a marathon, 26.2 miles, he would only burn around 2,600 calories, or approximately 3/4 of a pound of fat. How could Phelps eat an extra 9,000 calories per day? He scanned his finger through the columns, jotted down a few notes, and defaulted to the calculator. It made no sense. In order for Phelps to burn those kinds of calories above and beyond what his resting metabolic rate, RMR, was, Ray recalls, keeping in mind that I had the calculations in front of me, and it's about 860 calories an hour at competitive swimming rates, he would have to sustain more than 10 hours of continuous butterfly every day. Not even he can do that. So what was going on? Was Phelps misinforming journalists during his Olympic quest? Sabotaging competitors foolish enough to mimic him based on an interview? The physics didn't work. Then, in an instant, paused over the spreadsheet after 15 years of frustration, it all became crystal clear. It was the thermal load of the water. Water is 24 times more thermally conductive than air. Phelps spends 3 or 4 hours a day in the water. The effect was the same as pouring hot coffee into a metal cup instead of a ceramic mug. The former loses calories, heat, much faster. Ray did the math with this new variable, and amazingly, it seemed to add up. In the 6 weeks that followed, from the weekend of October 27th to December 5th, he would lose 28.6 pounds of fat and never regain them. The game had changed. It seemed too good to be true, so, as a good scientist would, Ray tried to disprove himself. In the studies and science he reviewed, what struck him most was not evidence that contradicted his conclusions, but rather the near-complete omission of heat as a factor in fat loss. The common equation in the literature was simple. Weight loss, or gain, equals calories in minus calories out. This wasn't the problem. The problem was that every table for calories out, caloric expenditure, immediately fixated on activity level. It wasn't that the laws of thermodynamics were wrong. It was that the laws weren't properly represented when applied to the human body. Thermodynamics had somehow been robbed of heat. In Ray's world of space shuttles and atmospheric re-entry, heat was king. The laws of thermodynamics were being cited by people who didn't understand them. Take the first law of thermodynamics as an example. In simple terms, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can only change forms. The misquoters were limiting the ways ingested calories could change forms. They treated exercise and storage as the only two options. In fact, the human body is an open thermodynamic system and has a number of options beyond those. Ray's then 209-pound meat frame could exchange energy with his environment in the form of work, exercise, heat, or matter, excretion. Running a marathon of 26.2 miles might burn 2,600 calories. Working out in an 82-degree Fahrenheit pool for 4 hours could burn up to an extra 4,000 calories, if one considered thermal load. How else could people like Scott Parazynski, a friend of Ray's, eat can after can of Spam and other high-fat foods? Scott was an MD and former astronaut and had attempted to summit Everest twice, losing about 25 pounds on each attempt. He was successful on his second ascent. His troop ate lard and sticks of butter to prevent excessive weight loss. The workload of the climb alone could not account for the caloric expenditure, a 5,000-calorie deficit. It was the cold. Lots of cold. So Ray began to treat himself like a human space heater. He tried everything. He drank a gallon of ice water between waking and 11 a.m. He slept with no covers. He took midwinter shiver walks of 20 to 30 minutes with nothing but a t-shirt, earmuffs, and gloves on his upper body. He later found less painful options, but the results were undeniable. He lost almost 6 pounds in the first week. This was not the first time Ray had tried to lose weight. In 2006, he lost a respectable 20 pounds following the Body for Life, BFL, exercise and diet plan designed by Bill Phillips. BFL performed as advertised, and Ray lost 17.8 pounds of fat in 12 weeks for an average weekly fat loss of 1.48 pounds. This was, by all conventional measures, a huge success. Unfortunately, in a pattern familiar to millions, he then gained it all back plus interest. In the second experiment, however, repeating BFL with intermittent cold exposure, Ray lost 28.6 pounds in 6 weeks for an average weekly fat loss of 4.77 pounds. The addition of cold exposure alone increased fat loss per week more than 3 times. This added up to 61% more total fat lost in 50% of the time. I found Ray's results both incredible and believable, but something was missing. First of all, he had also gained more muscle with cold exposure. Losing more heat couldn't account for that, though the muscle gain could have been accounted for by the slight inaccuracies of home-use calipers, plus or minus 2 pounds. I suspected there might be more to the story. Second, looking at the research, the math didn't seem to add up quite as neatly as I'd hoped. It's been shown that you can burn almost 4 times more fat than usual with 2 hours of cold exposure. 176.5 milligrams per minute instead of 46.9 milligrams per minute. This is great, but remember how deceptive percentage changes can be. If there are 9 calories in 1 gram of fat, and assuming the effect lasts for the time you're in the water, then this exposure would burn an extra 139 calories, 16 or 15.5 grams of fat. 15.5 grams? That's about 11 paper clips for 2 hours of torture. Ray was losing more than 3 additional pounds, approximately 1,350 grams of fat per week with cold exposures. To achieve that with water immersion alone, looking at the same studies, he'd need to spend 174.2 hours per week, or 24.9 hours per day, in 50-degree water. It seemed unlikely that Ray spent more than 24 hours per day in water. In fact, he didn't even spend 2 hours per day swimming in or consuming 50-degree water. Something else needed to be happening. It could have been the other thermic loads he experimented with, cold walks, sleeping without sheets, etc. Digging deeper still, I now believe that the something else, the X factor, involves two players you'll hear much more about in the next few years, BAT and adiponectin. Adiponectin is a cool little hormone secreted by fat cells that can both increase the oxidation, burning, of fatty acids in mitochondria and increase uptake of glucose by muscle tissue. I believe adiponectin is largely to thank for Ray's muscle gain. Speculation notwithstanding, the research is in its early stages, so I'll reserve adiponectin as an intellectual dessert for the geeks among you. My forays into its potential can be found in the online resources. BAT and my related torture experiments, on the other hand, are worth taking a closer look at. If the science gets too dense and you want the index card version, be careful. Skip to Ice Age Revisited, four places to start, at the end of this chapter. I won't be offended. If you're interested in learning to leverage fat-burning fat, on the other hand, keep listening. In 1999, amusingly, most researchers firmly believed that BAT, while abundant in infants, was non-existent, or, best case, negligible in adults. I was in the midst of my Guantanamo Bay baths at this time, and these conclusions did not square with my experience. It wasn't until years later that better tools, most notably positron emission tomography, PET, became more widespread and were used to demonstrate that BAT is most certainly present in adults, particularly in the neck and upper chest areas. That explains why the ice packs on my neck and upper trapezius worked. In the May 2009 issue of Obesity Review, a paper was published titled, "Have We Entered the BAT Renaissance?" I'd say the answer is yes. The abstract concludes, "These recent discoveries should revamp our effort to target the molecular development of brown adipogenesis in the treatment of obesity." Let's start with cold. It isn't fancy, but it works damn well. If we combine the research with preliminary data, there are four simple options you can experiment with for fat loss. Place an ice pack on the back of the neck or upper trapezius area for 20 to 30 minutes, preferably in the evening when insulin sensitivity is lowest. I place a towel on the couch while writing or watching a movie and simply lean back against the ice pack. Consume, as Ray did, at least 500 milliliters of ice water on an empty stomach immediately upon waking. In at least two studies, this water consumption has been shown to increase resting metabolic rate 24 to 30%, peaking at 40 to 60 minutes post-consumption, though one study demonstrated a lower effect of 4.5%. Eat breakfast 20 to 30 minutes later, a la the slow-carb diet. Take 5 to 10-minute cold showers before breakfast and or before bed. Use hot water for 1 to 2 minutes over the entire body, then step out of water range and apply shampoo and soap to your hair and face. Turn the water to pure cold and rinse your head and face alone. Then turn around and back into the water, focusing the water on your lower neck and upper back. Maintain this position for 1 to 3 minutes as you acclimate and apply soap to all the necessary regions. Then turn around and rinse normally. Expect this to wake you up like a foghorn. If you're impatient and can tolerate more, take 20-minute baths that induce shivering within 5 minutes. From geek to freak. How to gain 34 pounds in 28 days. On July 6, 65-year-old John's biceps measured 14.5 inches in circumference. 6 weeks later, his biceps measured a full 3/4 inch larger at 15.25 inches. How did he do it? He reduced his workouts from 3 per week to 2 per week. It was all planned, progressive reduction. You see, it turns out that most of the conventional wisdom about muscular growth is just dead wrong. From a training standpoint, there were four basic principles that made it happen, all of which will be expanded upon soon. 1. Perform one set to failure for each exercise. Follow Arthur Jones's general recommendation of one set to failure, i.e., reaching the point where you can no longer move the weight, for 80 to 120 seconds of total time under tension per exercise. Take at least 3 minutes of rest between exercises. 2. Use a 5-to-5 rep cadence. Perform every repetition with a 5-to-5 cadence. 5 seconds up, 5 seconds down, to eliminate momentum and ensure constant load. 3. Focus on 2-to-10 exercises per workout, no more. Focus on 2-to-10 exercises per workout, including at least one multi-joint exercise for pressing, pulling, and leg movements. The sequence I've used can be found at 4hourbody.com/exercises. 4. Increase recovery time along with size. This is described at length in the next chapter, Occam's Protocol. This is the exact protocol I suggest you follow. Occam's Protocol 1. A minimalist approach to mass. The goal of this chapter is to reduce everything to the absolute minimum. Before we get started, though, we need to discuss the bike shed effect. To illustrate this phenomenon, let's compare a conversation about building a nuclear power plant with building a bike shed. Most people rightly assume that they know nothing about something as complex as a nuclear power plant, and so won't voice an opinion. Most people wrongly assume, however, that they know something about building a bike shed, and will argue until the cows come home about every detail down to paint color. Everyone you meet, every male at least, will have a strong opinion about how you should train and eat. For the next 2 to 4 weeks, I suggest cultivating selective ignorance and refusing to have bike shed discussions with others. Friends, foes, colleagues, and well-intentioned folks of all stripes will offer distracting and counterproductive additions and alternatives. Nod, thank them kindly, and step away to do what you've planned. Nothing more and nothing different. Complicate to profit, minimize to grow. There is one default dictum in the diet and exercise industries. Complicate to profit. The objective of the minimalist routine in this chapter is not to make you a professional athlete, not to make you as strong as possible, though strength will increase and the gains will surpass most protocols. Here is our singular objective: to apply the MED necessary to trigger muscular growth mechanisms and then channel food preferentially into muscle tissue during overfeeding. There is one condition. We must do both as safely as possible. The safety issue is particularly important to understand when considering exercises. Don't get me wrong, all movements are safe when performed properly. This includes backflips on one leg, breakdancing, head spins, and the much vaunted snatch. The problem with such movements and dozens of others is that a minor technical mistake can cause serious, often permanent injuries. These injuries are underreported because, one, those affected don't want to be ostracized from communities that view the moves as gospel. And two, cognitive dissonance prevents them from admitting that a move is inherently high risk if they've advocated it for a long time. So what is used instead to explain the injury? I, he, she just didn't do it right. There is underreporting of diet failures, raw food as one example, for similar reasons. In fairness, can you do snatches safely? Sure. But if there are safer substitutes that provide 80% or more of the benefits, I will suggest those substitutes instead. In more than 15 years of resistance training, I've never been injured following the protocols I will describe here. I suggest adopting one rule of Dr. Ken Leistner, an NFL strength consultant I had the painful pleasure of training with in 1996. The goal of strength training is to reduce injury potential first and to increase performance second. Occam's Protocol is a variation of the consolidation routine used by the late Mike Mentzer, who won the heavyweight class of the Mr. Olympia competition in 1979. It is possible to get huge with less than 30 minutes of gym time per week. In the PDF, you'll see that the Occam's Protocol A and B workouts are alternated, whether you choose the machine or free weight option. The exercises should be performed for one set each and no more. The objective is to fail, to reach the point where you can no longer move the weight at 7 or more repetitions at a 5-to-5 cadence, 5 seconds up and 5 seconds down. The leg press is to be performed for 10 or more repetitions at the same cadence. The only exceptions to the cadence rule are the abdominal exercises and the kettlebell swing, which are also described in the PDF. Find them and give them a look. The mechanisms of growth we want to stimulate are both local, muscular, neural, and systemic, hormonal. The longer time under tension, TUT, for the lower body will elicit a greater full body growth hormone response while also stimulating the formation of new capillaries, which will improve nutrient delivery. As I've said, consult the PDF for a detailed look at the A and B workouts. For now, here are some rules to live by. If you complete the minimal target number of reps for all exercises, excluding abs and kettlebell swing, increase the weight the next workout at least 10 pounds for that exercise. If the additional 10 pounds feels easy after 2 to 3 reps, stop, wait 5 minutes, increase the weight an additional 5 to 10 pounds, then do your single set to failure. Do not just drop the weight when you hit failure. Attempt to move it, millimeter by millimeter, and then hold it at the limit for 5 seconds. Only after that should you slowly, take 5 to 10 seconds, lower the weight. The biggest mistake novice trainees make is underestimated the severity of complete failure. Failure is not dropping the weight after your last moderately strenuous rep. It is pushing like you have a gun to your head. To quote the ever-poetic Arthur Jones, if you've never vomited doing a set of barbell curls, then you've never experienced outright hard work. If you feel like you could do another set of the same exercise a minute later, you didn't reach failure as we are defining it. Remember that the last repetition, the point of failure, is the one that matters. The rest of the repetitions are just a warm-up for that moment. Do not pause at the top or bottom of any movements, except the bench press, as noted. And take 3 minutes of rest between all exercises. Time 3 minutes exactly with a wall clock or a stopwatch. Keep rest periods standardized so you don't mistake rest changes for strength changes. The weight and repetitions used will change as you progress, but all other variables need to be identical from one workout to the next. Rep speed, exercise form, and rest intervals. This is a laboratory experiment. To accurately gauge progress and tweak as needed, you must ensure that you control your variables. That's it. The temptation to add exercises will be enormous. Don't do it. If anything, if you've never been able to gain mass, you might choose to do less. The frequency of the A and B Occam workouts is based on a simple premise. You must increase recovery time along with size. You will exercise less frequently as you increase strength and size, as you can often increase muscle mass well over 100% before reaching a genetic ceiling. But your recovery abilities might only improve 20 to 30% through enzymatic and immune system upregulation, increased plasma glutamine production, etc. Put in simple terms, it takes non-growing repair systems longer to repair a 20-pound muscle than its 10-pound predecessor. The bigger and stronger you get, the less often you will go to the gym. Getting started. Step 1. Take at least 7 days off of all training that causes significant muscular damage. No bodyweight resistance training or weight training allowed. Step 2. Begin Occam's protocol with 2 days between A and B workouts. After two of both the A and B workouts, increase the rest days between workouts to 3 days. As soon as you have a workout where more than one exercise is stalled, but not before, increase to 4 days between workouts. Continue adding rest as needed to resolve plateaus until you hit your target weight or end your bulking cycle. Important caveat. This spacing assumes you are consuming enough food to support rapid growth. Of the trainees who fail to gain significant muscular weight, significant equals at least 2.5 pounds per week, on Occam's protocol, 95% plus of them fail due to insufficient caloric nutrient intake. The remaining 5% or less have nutrient absorption issues such as leaky gut syndrome, impaired stomach acid production, excessive fat excretion, insufficient bile, etc., or other conditions requiring medical attention before the protocol can do its job. I've encountered only one such clinical case in the 5% group. He was 124 pounds at 6'1", and even when he attempted to gain weight by eating bag after bag of donuts in 24-hour periods, he could not gain a single pound. Don't assume you are in this unlikely minority. The most common problem is insufficient food intake. That leads us to the real challenge of Occam's protocol. Eating. And here, once again, you'll have to consult the PDF file for details on Occam's feeding. While you're there, look at Occam's prescriptions, too. I've also included another discussion there, Occam's Protocol 2, which addresses finer points, common questions, and criticisms. Improving Sex. The 15-Minute Female Orgasm. Part Un. 9 p.m., Asha Thai Restaurant, San Francisco. My Thai food hovered between my plate and my mouth, broccoli dangling off the fork. Then it fell. I was focusing more on the conversation than the eating. For almost all women, the most sensitive part of the clit will be the upper left-hand quadrant from their perspective, around 1 o'clock from the man's perspective. Tallulah Sulis, a specialist in female ejaculation, paused to take a sip of water and raise her eyes to meet mine. Sometime, you should really try and meet Nicole Daydone. Tallulah was an old friend, and now my first orgasm consigliere. I wrote the name down on a note, and we meandered from our love life catch-up to other topics. 2 hours later, we settled the bill and I walked her to her car. As we ambled over the crosswalk, I turned to her and joked, "Now all I need to do is find a beautiful single girl who's never had an orgasm." It was a funny ending to an entertaining night. Little did I realize how important the note in my pocket would soon become. Exactly 24 hours later, serendipity entered stage left. I was enjoying French food and a bottle of Bordeaux with a female 25-year-old yoga instructor new to San Francisco, fresh from the Midwest. Talk drifted to the single scene and then to her culture shock in places like the Castro, where drag queens and transsexuals have dinner next to dot-com millionaires. Nothing is taboo, and she was just getting acclimated. SF is, after all, the world's capital city of sexual exploration. Several glasses further into the evening, she casually admitted that she'd never experienced an orgasm. How we got to that topic, I don't remember, but I looked around to see if God was playing a trick on me. Never won the Powerball lottery, but I assume the winners felt something like I felt then. My daydream was interrupted when her follow-up comment hit me like a ton of bricks. It's fine, though. I've realized that sex just isn't that important. Time out. What? I blurted a little too loudly. This gorgeous woman, in her prime, let's call her Giselle, had compartmentalized sex as an unimportant and uninteresting activity. As the wine flowed and we continued to talk, it became clear that this rationalization was a direct product of her inability to fully enjoy it. And so it came to be that I made her a drunken promise. I would fix her inability to orgasm. Not that night, not necessarily through me, but somehow. In retrospect, it was a foolish and overconfident promise. But with alcohol-induced optimism on my side, I viewed it as a watershed moment, an opportunity to harness my OCD for the greater good. Most men assume they kind of, sort of, understand female anatomy, but the upper left quadrant at 1 o'clock? That was a new one. Tallulah had given me a glimpse of a different world altogether. Later that evening, somewhere between Wikipedia and Pornhub, I realized Giselle wasn't alone. Sex researcher Sherry Haidt had long ago concluded that 70% of U.S. women couldn't experience orgasm from intercourse. And Alfred Kinsey's data suggested that up to 50% of U.S. women weren't able to achieve orgasm at all. My quest for the elusive female orgasm had begun. The outcome, 4 weeks later, was better than I ever could have imagined. I was able to facilitate orgasms, the word facilitate will be explained later, in every woman who acted as a test subject. The results? Those who'd never experienced manual-only orgasm were able to do so, and those who'd never experienced penetration-only orgasm were also able to do so. The success rate was 100%. Here is what I learned. The morning after wine with Giselle, I wrote down a number of questions that seemed like good starting points. Several of them related to extending male endurance, if that were to prove a limiting factor. I figured I might need to train men to become energizer bunnies. Some of the inbuilt assumptions reflected in the wording turned out to be totally wrong, but here are my original questions. How do you tweak the common sexual positions to make it more likely that the woman will orgasm? How can you reduce the refractory periods, the erection impossible period after ejaculation, for men? This would allow more sessions per night. Is it possible for men to have multiple orgasms without ejaculating? How do you keep it, the hoo-ha, that is, from stretching out over time? A female friend insisted I throw this one in. Once I had questions, I needed some answers. For that, I would need two things: experts and lots of practice. First things first, experts. There is no shortage of how-to sexual information. From Qigong Penis, competes with the Iron Penis Kung Fu School, to orgasm training on elaborate vibrator saddle machines like the Sibian. It's a paradox of choice problem. Considering the options, I quickly began to think that I might be reenacting The Snow Leopard by Peter Mathiasen. In 1973, Peter traveled with zoologist George Schaller 250 miles into Himalayan no man's land in search of the near-mythical snow leopard. Not to be a spoiler, but he didn't find the goddamn cat. He saw rare mountain sheep, foxes, wolves, even signs of the snow leopard itself, but it was never found. Fortunately, Peter's experience led to a Buddhist-like search for meaning and a beautiful classic in nature writing. I doubted I could pull the same beauty out of Iron Penis Kung Fu. My quest was all or nothing, and it needed a happy ending. I had no choice but to narrow down the field, to find someone who'd already tried everything. There was only one place to look. Nina Hartley became a registered nurse in 1985 after graduating magna cum laude from San Francisco State University. She also started stripping her sophomore year, which led to experimenting in adult films. It was not a college phase. Nina has since starred or featured in more than 650 porn films and is one of the most recognized and respected names in the business. Lexington Steele, the only person ever to win the AVN, the Oscars of Porn, Male Performer of the Year Award, three times, has publicly stated, without hesitation, that the single greatest sexual experience of his life was with Nina. My friend Sylvester Norwood later told me the same thing, but WTF? His confession confused me. Not because I doubted Nina had the skills, but how the hell did Sylvester enter the picture? The same well-behaved Jewish boy too shy to talk to girls? Shimmer and fade to reenactment. Straight out of Ripley's Believe It or Not, Sylvester's mom attended a group dinner in Berkeley, California, that Nina also happened to be attending, and the two ended up seated next to one another. Mrs. Norwood came home and said to then 22-year-old Sylvester, "Guess who I was at dinner with? A famous porn star, Nina Hartley. Have you ever heard of her?" Sylvester nearly choked. In his secret double life, he had a huge collection of videos featuring Nina, his personal snow leopard. "Mom, I have to meet her. If I never do anything again in this life, I must meet Nina Hartley." 3 days of insistent begging and nagging later, Sylvester's mom raised a hand and picked up the phone. "Hi, Nina, it's Mrs. Norwood. I had such a wonderful time meeting you at the party. Listen, I have a question for you. Do you ever make love to younger men?" Nina's answer? "Why, yes, I love breaking in younger men, but only once." And so it happened. Summary: coolest mom ever. A decade later, Sylvester is still friends with Nina, and he introduced us via email. The two-hour phone call that followed was a master's degree in all things sexual. But the most actionable highlights related to 1, the single most important precondition for female orgasm, and 2, technical modifications of positions. The precondition. Women need to step up to the starting line first. No man can give you an orgasm. He can only help you do it yourself. This is why I used the word facilitate earlier. First and foremost, Nina emphasized, a woman has to be comfortable masturbating. If she doesn't masturbate regularly, she'll be more trouble, baggage-wise, than it's worth. Unless you get off on being the fixer. She has to at least come up to the starting line and be comfortable conversing with her own orgasmic potential. For years, Nina herself was too embarrassed to show her O-face, her face during orgasm, to partners, thinking it was ugly or unattractive, not realizing that men go nuts for it. The woman needs to know how beautiful and exciting she is in that state. Truer words were never spoken. To those women who don't masturbate, Nina recommends starting in small increments. 5 minutes a night before bed, or immediately after waking up, and listening to self-talk. What is your head telling you? Unwarranted guilt and shame? Both will pass with practice, and you must be comfortable solo before it's possible with someone else. 30 minutes after the interview with Nina, I called Giselle. The verdict? She never masturbated. She was the eldest daughter in her family, an unexpected recurring theme I found among non-orgasmic women, and had been raised Catholic. Her mother used scare tactics with religious overtones, repeating phrases like, "I hope your decision to abstain includes remembering your faith." This fueled a feeling of obligation to be a role model for her younger sisters, and the end product of it all was predictable. She disallowed herself pleasure, viewing it as a hazard, and was now well on the path to asexuality. Step 1. I gave Giselle, who agreed to play along, the book Sex for One by Betty Dodson, along with a homework assignment to masturbate prior to bed for 5 minutes each night. Then I crossed my fingers. The next few weeks would show if her discomfort and disinterest could be fixed through simple conditioning. I hoped 5 minutes of nightly homework would be enough. The positions. Precision and pressure. Nina emphasized two slight modifications to most positions, changing the angle of penetration so that the head of the penis makes more contact with the female G-spot, which is generally about a quarter in size and 1 to 2 inches inside the vagina on the top side. If the male inserts an index finger up to the second knuckle, palm up, and makes a come-hither motion, the fingertip should touch a sponge-like tissue, or be within an inch of it. This is the G-spot. Changing the pressure of the position so that the man's pelvic bone is in direct contact with the clitoris. The descriptions you're about to hear are based on Nina's suggestions as well as my research testing. The three positions described were chosen because the woman need not necessarily stimulate herself, as would be the case in doggy style. Missionary position versus improved angle missionary. The woman's hips should be elevated on a pillow to tilt her hips toward her head. Nina suggests buckwheat hole pillows, which are firm and, unlike foam or feather pillows, don't collapse. I fell in love with them in Japan, as the holes conform to your head and neck to offer the perfect night's sleep. They conform equally well to female buttocks, while keeping them a perfect 6 or so inches off the bed. The man then moves his hips as close as possible to the woman's hips while keeping his heels under his buttocks. He should be sitting Japanese style, sitting on heels, with knees spread as wide as is comfortable. The lower he keeps his hips, the better the angle to hit the G-spot. Experiment with different depths of penetration. Using a rhythm of 9 shorter half-length penetrations with 1 long is particularly effective. Use the bottom of the opening of her vagina as a fulcrum for the penis, which will act as a lever. The woman should test A, pulling her knees toward her chest to tilt her hips toward her, and B, placing her feet flat on the bed to elevate her hips. One will usually feel awesome, while the other will feel awkward. Note for the big gents on long strokes. If your penis is apt to hit her cervix in this position, which is not pleasant for women, open up one hip, as they say in the adult film business. Putting her belly button at 12 noon, aim your penis at 10 or 2 o'clock. This works for all positions where deep penetration is possible. Doggy style, knees on shoulders, etc. Pain isn't sexy unless the woman tells you it is. Improved pressure missionary. To accomplish this position, the male must shift his weight forward a few inches. First, he must straighten his legs. Bringing them closer together makes this easier, so the knees are off of the bed. Then he'll support more weight on her pelvis, the entire purpose, and his arms. This changes the angle of penetration so that the focal point of friction is no longer the head of the penis against the vaginal wall, but rather the man's pelvic bone on the woman's clitoris. This kills 2 birds with 1 stone. The man can last far longer, and the woman receives direct clitoral stimulation. This modification was recommended by Nina, but she is not alone. Tallulah was emphatic. The number one move I would offer to men is the targeted pelvic grinding in this position, either moving the hips in small circles or slowly side to side. I later found bracing the abdomen muscles, even extending them a bit, and rocking the hips back and forth in a short 1 to 2 inch motion to be most effective. Imagine that, from just below your navel to the base of your penis, you are connected to the woman. Never lose contact with the clitoris. If you do this right, expect to feel like you did 1,000 sit-ups the next day. Just remember what one friend said to me as I ground the gears of my car on a steep hill in San Francisco. If you can't find it, grind it. Bad advice in cars, good advice in girls. Conventional cowgirl position versus improved pressure cowgirl position. Improved pressure cowgirl puts the woman on top and recreates the same penile position as in improved pressure missionary. The man should not be flat on his back, nor should he be sitting straight up. He should be leaning back about 20 degrees. This can be accomplished with pillows on a bed or, ideally, on an armless chair with a back that the woman can hold on to. The advantage of this position is simple. The woman can control the motion. Professor Nina offers the following advice for all intercourse. When in doubt, you supply the pressure and she provides the movement. The male can hold a vibrator to the clit in this position, but I opted not to because of the risk of distraction on both sides. As Nina-san saith, a vibrator can be a girl's best friend, or it can be as annoying as a mosquito. I could always bring in the heavy artillery after the fact, but I wanted to be ready for empty-handed encounters. I wanted to deconstruct the orgasm and create it at will without any tools. That's when the note in my pocket became the keys to the kingdom. The 15-minute female orgasm. Part 2. Stupid animals. Here's a composite scene that repeats itself millions of times per night around the world. Man finally gets to go downtown and fumbles to get his hand where it counts. Man starts random up and down or circular motion, hoping to God he can hit the spot and not act surprised. Woman moans and man thinks he's doing well. Woman stops moaning. Man shifts technique or goes into hyperdrive, and woman asks him to slow down a bit. Man slows down and exactly 5 seconds of mild positive response later, nothing. Man feels like a dog trying to open a door with no thumbs. If he's out to beat the clitoris, dead or alive, as most men are, woman gently stops his increasingly erratic attack after 10 minutes. Best case, they move on to something the man can understand, like penis and vagina. He's a stupid animal, folks. Have mercy. The clitoris looks something like an Imperial Guard from Star Wars. It's also much larger than most people realize. The clitoral glands, what most refer to as the clit, extends back and splits into an upside-down V. Those legs, the clitoral crura, are concealed behind the labia minora. Some researchers believe that G-spot stimulation is actually stimulation of the crura, and that all orgasms originate from stimulation of the clitoris. Some researchers, mostly male, disagree. It's not hard to understand why men pretend it doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, or if it's unpredictable, men can write it off as a female problem. Leaving dinner with Tallulah, I became fixated on the idea of a hypersensitive upper left quadrant on the clitoris. Could it really be that straightforward? I walked home from the restaurant that evening and jumped on my laptop to begin researching the one method Tallulah had mentioned by name, the doing method. 72 hours later, I tested the upper quadrant technique on a willing test subject who'd never experienced an orgasm from finger-only stimulation. 2 strong peaking orgasms and an extended 15-minute continuous orgasm followed. I was shocked, speechless. It worked on the first shot. Now I just needed to make the technique bulletproof. To do that, I would need to meet not just a master, but the master. Luckily, I had her name in my pocket on a little scrap of paper. Nicole Dadone. Origins, Moore University. Lafayette Morehouse was established by Dr. Victor Barranco in 1968 on Person Lane in Lafayette, California. Operating as Moore University from 1977 to 1997, it was a commune founded on the ideal of responsible hedonism. The residents painted the buildings and automobiles on the property purple, and their newsletter explained the rationale. "We tell people that all the houses here are purple so that there is no mistake that one has changed realities should they wander onto our property." If people missed the purple, there were other warning signs for wanderers. In the 1960s, Barranco and his wife Susie began researching how to improve their sex lives. Both believed that the amount of sensual pleasure available to an individual far exceeded the expectations commonly held in society. In 1976, after more than a decade of experimentation, they blew the floodgates open by giving the first public demonstration of female orgasm. It lasted 3 hours. That's a genital dances with wolves. The female student who demonstrated the orgasm, Diana, recalled the result it had on the wall-to-wall audience. "When that demonstration was over, people ran to every available space on the property so that they could get off too. Get the women off. It was really the women." Not surprisingly, students flocked to Morehouse. Two students of the Morehouse methods for extending orgasm were Doctors Steve and Vera Badansky, founders of the doing method I had taken for a test drive. Another was Ray Vetterlein, who took his first class at Morehouse in 1968, 8 years before the public demo. He earned its highest private qualification in 1989 and has been refining his methods ever since, for more than 40 years. Less than a month after dinner with Tallulah, I was witnessing some of Ray's findings firsthand. "You want to use about 2 sheets of paper worth of pressure," explained my chaperone, Iko, who had organized the visit and was sitting to my right. "Roger that. Go by how it feels, not by how it sounds." I scribbled down notes as 4 one-taste practitioners, 2 seated next to me and 2 on the floor, demonstrated and explained the fine-tuning I needed. One Taste was founded in 2001 by Nicole Dedone, a student of Morehouse and Vetterlein, to give women a clean and brightly lit place to learn about orgasm from another woman. I'd met with Nicole the afternoon before, and our conversation had started at neuroscience and ended with me recounting my trial run of the doing method. One thing was clear to her. There was much room for improvement. Now I found myself at One Taste's coaching location in the SoMa district of San Francisco. Their expansion in both New York City and California has been funded largely by Reese Jones, who sold his software company Netopia to Motorola for $208 million. The slow sex movement thus began, and Nicole was its default leader. "So can I ask exactly where you are touching the clit now? It's still in upward motion?" I was positioned on an office chair with my elbows on my knees, looking down at the woman's vulva from about 5 feet away, where she and her male partner were positioned on pillows and throw rugs. "You can get closer," said Iko. "Sure, get as close as you need to," added the woman on her back. So I did. I watched from a distance of about 2 feet, sometimes closer, as the woman's entire physiology changed over 15 minutes, asking questions and watching the man's technique. Then it was my turn. "Are you ready?" Iko asked. Sure. Personal clitoral coaching was the last thing I thought I'd be doing at 10 a.m. on a weekday, but I already had 4 pages of detailed notes. If I didn't put theory into practice now, none of it would make sense later. So on went the latex gloves. My research partner arrived, and we repeated what I'd just seen. The two coaches who'd been sitting next to me earlier were now seated in front of me, kneeling about 3 feet from the woman's clitoris. They reached in occasionally to correct my hand position and offered intermittent suggestions. "Ensure your forearm is parallel to her body." Or encouragement. "Good stroke." It was like playing for the coolest little league team in the world. "Go, Timmy, go!" My partner experienced all of the involuntary muscle contraction I had hoped for, and the group coaching, though a little weird, wasn't uncomfortable in the least. Aiko asked me if I had any feedback after the session ended. I did. This should be required education for every man on the planet. The practice and how to, the 15-minute orgasm. I believe the two principal reasons the one taste method works so well is that one, it is presented as a goalless practice, and two, it decouples orgasm from sex. Kissing, fondling, disrobing, whispering, and requesting are all fun and wonderful parts of sex. Unfortunately, multitasking these actions often splits the attention a woman needs to reach orgasm. We'll develop singular focus through isolated practice, and it can later be brought into sex. The technique requires 15 minutes of 100% concentration on approximately 3 square millimeters of contact. Nothing more. Test this and practice it. The payoff can alter your sexual experiences forever. I'll explain this from the standpoint of a man, as that's what I am. 1. Explain to your partner that this is a goalless practice. This is 100% critical. There is no objective, just a focus on a single point of contact. The phrasing should emphasize this and remove all expectations and pressure. I'm going to touch you for 15 minutes. You don't need to do anything, and you don't have to do anything afterward. There is nowhere to get to, nothing to make happen. Just focus on the single point of contact. It's an exercise. The only focus should be on the short stroke, one stroke, one stroke, just as the emphasis would be on the breath, one breath, one breath, in most forms of meditation. View it as an exercise in mindful awareness. There is no goal. 2. Get into position. First, the woman disrobes from the waist down and lies on her back using a pillow for neck support. Her legs are bent and spread, feet together, in butterfly position. If this makes her hips uncomfortable on one or both sides, pillows can be put underneath her knees. Based on the premise that it is easier to achieve the proper angle of contact with the left hand, the man should sit to her right side on top of at least two pillows and straddle his bent left leg perpendicularly across her torso, foot flat on the opposite side. Add as many pillows as necessary to relieve any pressure from his left leg on her abdomen. Too many is better than too few. His right leg is straight or relaxed in butterfly position. Despite the left-handed positioning, which is ideal, I'm right-handed and impatient with poor fine motor control. I had more consistent luck sitting on the woman's left side and using my right hand. If you choose to do the same, it's important to tilt your right wrist toward you slightly, as if you were looking at a watch. This creates a better finger angle. 3. Set the timer for 15 minutes, find the upper quadrant point of greatest sensation, and stroke. Limit the session to exactly 15 minutes. I used a kitchen timer. This removes performance pressure and creates a safe start and end container for the woman. Look at it as you would a yoga routine or deep breathing sequence. It is an exercise in focused repetition, not a goal. Finding the upper quadrant and anchoring. Separate the labia. Retract the clitoral hood upward with the heel of the palm. Anchor the clitoris with the thumb. Put your other hand under her buttocks, two fingers under each cheek, with the thumb resting on, not in, the base of the entrance to the vagina, ring of introitus. This will act as an anchor and help the woman to relax. Imagine you are looking directly at the clitoris from between her legs, with the top of the clitoris as 12 o'clock on a clock face. Find 1 p.m., ideally a small indentation or pocket between the hood and her clitoris, with your index finger, and begin stroking using the lightest touch possible, and only 1/16th of an inch or so of movement. The tip of the finger is better than the pad, so cut your nails beforehand. Nicole emphasizes the start. If I can suggest one thing to the guys, take the time to find the spot. Once you find it, she won't be able to take more than a very light touch, like brushing satin against her skin. stroke like a metronome, at a constant speed for periods of 2 to 3 minutes. But feel free to change speed between periods. Ground at the end. Once the 15 minutes have elapsed, grounding is performed to ease the woman out of the experience. Though there are sophisticated options for this closing portion, it will suffice for novice males to apply strong pressure down on the pubic bone and up toward the woman's head, using overlapping hands. Let her dictate the pressure. Most women, in my experience, find the strongest possible pressure the most pleasurable for ending a session. I initially thought this closing portion was a waste of time. Grounding? It sounded like a bunch of New Age nonsense. Now I believe that grounding is most important, not as some type of energetic witchcraft, but rather for closure. It consummates a complete experience with beginning, setup, middle, stroking, and end, grounding. This format gives both parties a sense of accomplishment that artfully helps avoid fixation on a full-blown orgasm as closure. Remember that it's the goalless nature of the practice that allows the relaxation that produces the orgasm. This guaranteed outcome, grounding, is smart and, I now believe, critical to include. Based on coaching and practice, here are some helpful guidelines. Light contact. Remember, 2 pages of paper depth of pressure. No more. It takes a lot of strength and concentration to stroke lightly. It isn't building toward anything. Keep the practice goalless and remember the intention. Singularly focused repetition for 15 minutes. Consider using a blindfold or airline eye mask on the woman. I found it makes them less self-conscious and increases tactile sensitivity. Have her turn off the show. She doesn't need to please you. Make this clear. She doesn't need to moan and groan. It's about subtle sensation and nothing extra. Make it fun and even call it an experiment. Serious equals tension. Keep it light. Related to this, no idle chatter. Some women will talk to distract themselves and prevent orgasm or to prevent facial expressions of pleasure. This is an exercise in overcoming embarrassment, so the talking crutch should be removed. Using an eye mask helps minimize the talking impulse. Reinforce relaxation gently if the woman seems tense or anxious. I noticed you're tense. Try and relax a little bit. If she's experiencing strong contractions, which will clearly exhaust her before 15 minutes are up, encourage her to breathe and push out slightly as if she were going to pee. She won't pee, and it will help her extend the plateau and minimizing fatigue. Most common mistakes. Being goal-oriented. This includes women who will ask for insertion or penetration. Do not oblige them until the 15 minutes are up. Sex is fine afterward, but not until the session is finished. Don't give in. She might beg in the moment, but will thank you later for holding off. Once you've completed 5 15-minute sessions without caving in, feel free to break the rules and go nuts before 15 minutes are up, but not until you've followed the rules for 5 sessions. Asking non-winning questions of the woman almost guarantees lying, such as, "Does it feel good?" or "Are you enjoying this?" Asking questions is encouraged, but use directional questions instead. Would you like a lighter or stronger stroke? More to your left or right? Higher or lower? Using too much pressure. I consciously focused on a light touch when practicing the doing method for the first time, and I assumed it was light enough. It wasn't. I was using at least 3 times too much pressure. Imagine tickling a sleeping friend's nose just enough to make him scratch his own nose, but not enough to wake up. Once you're comfortable with a basic practice, 5 stroke-only sessions, but not before, try these. Insert the middle finger of the non-stroking hand, palm up, and use a come-hither motion to stimulate the G-spot. After 5 minutes, add in the index finger for a total of 2 fingers and continue the come-hither motion. Place a buckwheat pillow under her hips for the same angle as the improved angle missionary and use your left thumb to anchor the clitoris while you perform cunnilingus at the 1 o'clock upper quadrant of the clit. Do this as lightly as you would perform the stroke for at least 5 minutes without finger insertion, and then add a finger. Build a strong neck so she doesn't pop your head off. So did Giselle get to the finish line? Yes, and she ended up getting much more. It started with her masturbation homework assignments. I'm similar to my closest friends in most ways, so I'd assume this would also be the case. It wasn't. I was the only one who didn't masturbate. Once she started talking to her girlfriends about it, the entire subject became less taboo and became normal. Suddenly, sex wasn't something to be avoided. Now, it was something fun to talk about over a glass of wine. She'd also realized that she'd been suppressing a critical part of herself, and that without a developed sexuality, she wasn't a fully developed person. It took discipline to overcome old habits and subconscious sabotage. It was really tempting to come home from work and say, "Oh, I'm tired," and go to bed without doing it. I really had to view it as a practice, just like yoga. Practice is something you do even when you don't want to. Rediscovering her sensual self went far beyond the bedroom. Giselle started taking salsa lessons and rediscovering the incredible pleasure of feeling comfortable as a sexual being, comfortable in her own skin. She finally felt free to express herself, not in a haphazard manner, but free from unwarranted guilt or shame. The mind can rationalize terrible voids, and there is no need for it. Life is short, and sex should be a wonderful part of it. It's a fundamental part of our natural hardwiring. Isn't it time you let your hair down and had some real fun with it? All it takes is 15 minutes. Sex Machine 1. Adventures in Tripling Testosterone. Noonish, one beautiful Saturday, San Francisco, 21 floors above the Embarcadero piers. That's kind of creepy. They're already 75% healed. Marie had come out of the shower and was staring at my shoulders. "Are you kidding? It's fucking awesome! I'm becoming Wolverine!" I was referring to, of course, the superhero with mutant healing powers. He also has adamantium claws, but that's where Marie was a much better comparison. The night before, she'd inflicted bedroom wounds on my back and arms that couldn't really be called scratches. The masterpiece? 4 4-to-7-inch gashes in my right shoulder streaming blood, making me look like Bruce Lee from Enter the Dragon. Bruce in dire need of Neosporin. Now, less than 10 hours later, 3 of the gashes had disappeared completely, and the last and deepest was barely visible. Strange. The strangeness had actually started earlier, well before the bedroom, at the Americano restaurant. Friday at 8 p.m. brought the crowds, and the alpha investment bankers were fighting the alpha lawyers for female attention everywhere inside and around Hotel Vital. The press shirts and dresses spilled from the outdoor patio into the restaurant, where we had reservations. It took a chaperone, using football-like blocking, to get us to our booth table in a secluded back corner. The catch-up chat with Marie looked like this. Her: "How are you?" Me: "Unbelievable, but I need to give you fair warning. My biochemistry is very different from the last time you saw me. I feel, well, superhuman." Her: eyebrows raised. "Oh, really? Details, please." "Yes, really. The last time I'd seen her, I had just taken my total testosterone from 244.8 to 653.3 ng per DL. Nanograms per deciliter, while cutting my estradiol, estrogen, in half. The subsequent roughhousing had been a physical encounter of the first class. This time around, I'd just returned from Nicaragua, where I ate grass-fed beef 3 times per day for 21 days, and I had protein-loaded for the last 3 days, eating 2 to 3 pounds of fatty organic grass-fed beef per day, including at least 400 grams just before bed. Don't worry, I won't suggest that you do this. The result? 15 minutes after we sat down, Marie was in a sexually aggressive stupor. The bread hadn't even arrived, and she was climbing on top of me. This is not a boast.
It's a statement of pure confusion. She is a CEO, and this is not typical public CEO behavior. I thought she was on drugs. Heavy nose breathing and the whole lot, interrupted occasionally with, "What's going on? I don't understand what's going on." The whole spectacle was unreal. She was literally intoxicated on pheromones. I excused myself to the bathroom at one point, and what came next was even less believable. Totally absurd. But it did happen, and Marie witnessed it when we left. Both on my way to the bathroom and coming back to the table, it was as if I had a 10-foot radius field of hormonal impact. I received at least 3 times the normal eye contact from women. The animal kingdom was alive and well in San Francisco. Dinner ended immediately thereafter, and it was a short trip to her apartment on the 21st floor and our version of Enter the Dragon, complete with furniture smashing and most of the same sound effects. The next morning, after more of the same, I asked her, "Do you have a gong on the other side of your headboard?" It turned out to be metal artwork hanging on a neighbor's wall. After her second quick shower and taking another look at my shoulder, Marie glanced up at me and had just one thing to say. "Whatever you're doing, keep doing it." Things hadn't always been this way. In fact, for several years, things were quite the opposite. Somewhere between late 2007 and 2009, at 30 to 32 years old, I found myself in an odd place. Well able to perform in the bedroom as I had in college, but having less and less desire to do so. Even with the most attractive of girls, after a week or two of rabbit love, sex frequency would drop to once a day. Then it would drop to a few times a week, or in some cases, once a week. I enjoyed sex as much as ever, once in the act, but fatigue or disinterest often led me to opt out. "I'll get to it in the morning" became a constant self-promise, often unfulfilled. It made no sense. I was young, athletic, and felt perfectly healthy. But looking under the hood, I also tested in the lower range of normal for total testosterone and blood testing. What was the problem? Testosterone is a molecule of many dependencies. The hypothalamus releases gonadotropin-releasing hormone, GnRH, which tells the pituitary, anterior pituitary, gland to release luteinizing hormone, LH, and follicle-stimulating hormone, FSH. LH then stimulates the late egg cells in the testicles to produce, ta-da, testosterone. It is a major but rampant mistake to treat low testosterone with external testosterone in the form of a gel or injection without troubleshooting the upstream parts of the axis first. It's also a mistake to think of low libido as strictly a low testosterone problem. In 2004, I experimented with a hormone and drug called human chorionic gonadotropin, commonly known as HCG, which effectively acts as a form of luteinizing hormone. Injected once per week, it immediately had the effect of more than tripling seminal volume and requiring ejaculation 3 to 4 times per day just to think straight. If you want to kill productivity, look no further than HCG. This inconvenience was compensated for by sex with my girlfriend, which jumped from a few times a week to a few times a day. Happy days. My solution? 2 protocols. I didn't consume much red meat for my first increase from 244.8 to 653.3 ng per dl. And I believe this type of jump can be achieved without eating red meat at all. The meat marathon was actually for tracking changes in food allergies. I now use 2 protocols that I believe are effective for increasing both testosterone and LH based on repeated blood test results. Neither requires needles or prescription meds. The first is for long-term maintenance and general well-being. The second is for short-term nitro boosts of sex drive and testosterone. Sheer fun, in other words. If you're curious, you can find the detailed rationales behind each in Sex Machine 2, but let's start with the nutshell version. Protocol number 1, long-term and sustained. Fermented cod liver oil plus vitamin-rich butterfat, 2 capsules upon waking and before bed. Vitamin D3,
3,000 to 5,000 IU upon waking and before bed, 6,000 to 10,000 IU per day, until reaching blood levels of 55 ng per ml. Short ice baths and or cold showers, 10 minutes each, upon waking and right before bed. Brazil nuts, 3 nuts upon waking, 3 nuts before bed. Protocol number 2, short-term and fun nitro boost. 20 to 24 hours prior to sex, eat at least 800 milligrams of cholesterol. Example, 4 or more large whole eggs or egg yolks. Within 3 hours of bedtime, the night before you want to be a sex maniac. The Wolverine intro to this chapter was partially thanks to 2 3-quarter-pound ribeye steaks the night before, but it's easier to stomach hard-boiled eggs. Why before bed? Testosterone is derived from cholesterol, which is primarily produced at night during sleep, between midnight and 4 to 6 a.m. 4 hours prior to sex. Brazil nuts, 20 raw almonds, 2 capsules of the fermented cod butter combination. Eager to give it a shot? This chapter is enough to get started, but the real magic happens when we finesse the details. Perfecting sleep. Engineering the perfect night's sleep. God, what a beautiful beach. Calm. Translucent turquoise water. I should really go back to Thailand. I wonder what time it is in Thailand. But why is there a mangy German shepherd on my beach? Orange collar? That makes no sense. Kind of looks like John's dog. Oh, actually, I owe John a call. Fuck, did I put his birthday party in the calendar? Birthdays and clowns. Clowns? Why the hell am I thinking about clowns? And so my internal monologue continues until 3, 4, or even 6 a.m., rotating through images, ideas, commitments, anxieties, and fantasies. This mental slideshow is combined with perverse sleep yoga, sometimes the twisted into a pretzel posture, sometimes lying on my back like Dracula in mock paralysis, and always ending in a last-ditch fetal position with a pillow or arm between the knees. Fetal position never works, but I continue to try it, like a full-bladdered dog scratching at a door that never opens. I have insomnia. Horrific onset insomnia. My brother and father are the same. It's not because we're stressed out, necessarily. It's not because we're not tired. It's because we just can't freaking fall asleep. So in the interest of finally getting a good night's rest and helping others with insomnia, I tried everything from folk remedies to smart drugs, from light therapy to fat leaching. Now I can say that I had chronic insomnia. The hidden third of life. Is good sleep a simple matter of length? The longer, the better? If you've ever needed a nap after sleeping too much, you know it isn't that simple. Let's look at the problem through an easier question. What is bad sleep? Taking too long to get to sleep, onset insomnia, my major problem. Waking too often throughout the night, middle insomnia. Waking too early and being unable to get back to sleep, terminal insomnia. The challenge for a self-tracker is measuring things when drooling into a pillow. I could record the times when I got into bed and when I woke up, but I couldn't pinpoint when I fell asleep, much less what happened while asleep. Taking courses like Biology of Sleep at Stanford University didn't fix my insomnia, but the academic searching did help me formulate more specific questions, including, for memory consolidation, how much REM sleep am I experiencing? For tissue repair, how much delta wave sleep am I experiencing? For both of these, am I experiencing sleep apnea? The problem with testing these in a proper sleep lab, the test is called a polysomnogram, is that you generally have at least 22 wires attached to you to measure brain activity, EEG, eye movements, EOG, skeletal muscle activation, EMG, heart rhythm, ECG, respiration, and sometimes peripheral pulse oximetry. Guess what? No one can sleep in a weird lab with 22 wires attached to them on the first night, so the data are terrible. But let's assume you try. The second night, you come in after an all-nighter and crash within minutes like a post-sugar-high 2-year-old. Double bad data. To really test and tweak things under realistic sleeping conditions, I would need a pocket-sized sleep lab. That wouldn't happen until 2009. July 2009. You should try what Brad Feld used. He has some gadget to measure your sleep, offered my friend, Matt Mullenweg. This caught my attention. I had been bitching about my insomnia after another horrible night's sleep, and I'd also been meaning to reach out to Brad. Based out of beautiful Boulder, Colorado, Brad is a venture capitalist and angel investor famous for, one, his incredible track record, and two, dropping F-bombs on business panels. Exhibit A, he was one of the few initial backers of Harmonix Music Systems, which he helped raise $500,000 in financing. They bled money for almost 11 years, a fool's errand. Then, in 2005, it had a small, read sarcasm, video game success called Guitar Hero. It sold in 2006 to Viacom MTV for $175 million. Brad's contrarian decisions often follow an elegant logic that others pick up on only well after the fact. If he had found a tool for sleep analysis, I wanted to know all about it. Brad's obsession ended up being the Zio. It would be my first legitimate next-generation sleep gadget. Then, I added to the list. In the subsequent 4 months of testing, I also used heart rate monitors, thermometers, continuous glucose monitors, 2 movement detection devices, Fitbit and WakeMe, and video recording of sleep movement. Often all simultaneously. I looked like a comatose RoboCop. Both WakeMate and Fitbit, worn on your wrist during sleep, use motion-sensing technology, accelerometry, similar to what's found in a Nintendo Wii controller. The data are interpreted using actigraphy algorithms, which are used to determine whether someone is awake or in one of the various stages of sleep. WakeMate features an alarm clock that can be set to wake you during specific arousal points in REM sleep, ostensibly to minimize grogginess, up to 30 minutes before a chosen wake time. The Zio, in contrast, uses a headband that measures electrical patterns generated in the brain. It also has an alarm clock intended to wake you during periods of most elevated brain activity, to minimize grogginess. The first attempts to track and fix things were not encouraging. For both accelerometer devices, time to fall asleep, the critical problem of onset insomnia, did not appear accurate. Despite claims to the contrary, it didn't appear that the accelerometers could distinguish between simple lack of movement and sleeping. I tested this by watching television for 30 minutes, remaining as perfectly still as possible before attempting to sleep. My sleep started approximately when I started watching TV. The first good news came a week later. The intelligent alarms, Zio and WakeMate, seemed to reduce grogginess. I was less bastardly in the morning and could think without 2 cups of coffee. Placebo, or true cause and effect, the smart alarms seemed to help. This was an improvement, but I needed better sleep, not just better wake times. This is where the Zio came in. I began with a trial period of answering a subjective question each morning and assigning a number. Do I feel like shit? 1 to 3. Or do I feel awesome? 8 to 10. Nebulous answers between 4 and 7 that would skew interpretation were logged but ignored. In both extreme ranges, I then looked for patterns. Thanks to the continuous glucose monitoring, I also had food logs to use. Here are some of the initial findings. Good sleep, 8 to 10, was most dependent on the ratio of REM to total sleep, not total REM duration. The higher the percentage of REM sleep, the more restful the sleep. The higher the REM percentage, the better the recall of skills or data acquired in the previous 24 hours. Higher percentage REM sleep also correlated to lower average pulse and temperature upon waking. I could increase REM percentage by extending total sleep time past 9 hours or by waking for 5 minutes approximately 4.5 hours after sleep onset.
One waking of 5 to 10 minutes, approximately 4.5 hours after sleep onset, dramatically increased REM percentage. It seems that one waking is not necessarily a bad thing, at least when intentional. Taking 200 milligrams of Huperzine A 30 minutes before bed can increase total REM by 20 to 30%. Huperzine A, an extract of Huperzine serrata, slows the breakdown of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. It is a popular nootropic smart drug, and I have used it in the past to accelerate learning and increase the incidence of lucid dreaming. I now only use Huperzine A for the first few weeks of language acquisition and no more than 3 days per week to avoid side effects. Ironically, one documented side effect of overuse is insomnia. The brain is a sensitive instrument, and while generally well-tolerated, this drug is contraindicated with some classes of medications. Speak with your doctor before using. The higher the percentage of deep wave sleep, the better your subsequent physical performance. More than 2 glasses of wine within 4 hours of sleep decreases deep wave sleep 20 to 50%. Even 4 glasses 6 hours beforehand did not appear to have this effect, so the timing is crucial. Conversely, taking 15-plus drops of California poppy extract appear to increase deep wave sleep up to 20%. Eating 2 tablespoons of organic almond butter on celery sticks before bed eliminated at least 50% of the feel-like-shit, 1 to 3, mornings. Ever wonder how you can sleep 8 to 10 hours and feel tired? The likely culprit? Low blood sugar. Make a pre-bed snack part of your nutritional program. 1 to 2 tablespoons of flaxseed oil, 120 to 240 calories, can be used in combination with the celery and almond butter to further increase cell repair during sleep and thus decrease fatigue. Flaxseed oil tastes like a mixture of cat urine and asparagus, so if you opt to include it, I recommend pinching your nose while consuming it, per Dr. Seth Roberts. Engineering more restful sleep out of the way, I moved on to the biggest problem, getting to sleep in the first place. No matter how theoretically restful my sleep should be, based on Zio results, more than 30 minutes of onset insomnia negated it all. What follows are the changes and tools that had the largest and most predictable effects on time to sleep. Some of them are more convenient than others. I excluded drugs from testing, and if a given improvement couldn't be replicated at least 3 times on consecutive nights, it was omitted. Test 67 to 70 degrees as your bedroom temperature. This was the variable I experimented with most, and it was also the variable that had the most consistent effects. Specifically, using a single bedsheet at room temperature between 67 degrees Fahrenheit and 70 degrees Fahrenheit produced the fastest time to sleep. Warmer temperatures never worked, but as low as 65 degrees Fahrenheit would work equally well if I wore socks to keep my feet warm. If you can't control the ambient temperature, testing socks of different thicknesses is the easiest variable to change for tweaking heat loss. Ideal temperature is highly individual, and each person will have a narrow range, so experiment to find your own. Eat a large fat and protein-dominated meal within 3 hours of bedtime. I discovered this unintentionally while tracking testosterone changes. Consumed within 3 hours of getting under the sheets, meals of at least 800 milligrams of cholesterol, 4 or more large whole eggs, and 40 grams of protein produce dramatically faster time-to-sleep scores than meals of lower volume or lower protein and fat. Eating 2 ribeye steaks, each about 3/4 of a pound, had the strongest tranquilizer-like effect. Use light cues. The Philips Go Light. I bought this high-end blue light emitter for a friend who suffers from seasonal affective disorder, SAD, a.k.a. mild to severe depression during winter months. He already owned the same device, so I began to use it as a replacement for coffee first thing in the morning. I set it to the side of my laptop, pointing at me for 15 minutes at about a 30-degree off-center angle, if noon is my laptop, pointing at me from 10 a.m. or 2 p.m. That evening, my time to sleep was less than 10 minutes for the first time in weeks. I was able to replicate the effect 4 nights out of 5. Though most often used for jet lag or winter depression, I found the Go Light to be singularly most useful as a corrective sleep tool, even if I wake up late and need to go to bed at a normal hour. Battery life is long, and at the size of a small square book, the Go Light is portable enough to fit in a carry-on travel bag. Tax the nervous system with isolateral movements. Exercise is commonly recommended to improve sleep. The problem for me was that results were unpredictable. I might exercise for 20 minutes and fall asleep in 10 minutes. Or I might exercise for an hour and fall asleep in 2 hours. There was no repeatable cause and effect, and it seemed like a coin toss. This changed when I began to incorporate isolateral, one arm or one leg, resistance training. I logged faster to sleep times after 8 out of 10 training sessions. The more complex the stabilization required, the shorter the to sleep time. Take a cold bath 1 hour prior to bed. The Japanese have longer average lifespans than most other ethnicities, including Americans, whom they beat by more than 4 years. One explanation researchers have proposed is that the regular ofuro, or hot bath at bedtime, increases melatonin release and its related mechanisms for life extension. Paradoxically, according to one of the Stanford professors who taught the sleep biology class I took circa 2002, cold is a more effective signaler, a.k.a. Zeitgeber, or time giver, for sleep onset. Perhaps the ofuro effect was related to the subsequent rapid cooling? Not eager to kill my swimmies with hot baths, I opted for direct cold. I tested the effect of combining shorter-than-usual 10-minute ice baths with low-dose melatonin, 1.5 to 3 milligrams, 1 hour prior to sleep. The ice bath is simple. Put 2 to 3 bags of ice from a convenience store, $3 to $6, into a half-full bathtub until the ice is about 80% melted. Beginners should start by immersing the lower body only and progress to spending the second 5 minutes with the upper torso submerged as well, keeping the hands out of the water. It was like getting hit with an elephant tranquilizer. Best of all, this was true even when the melatonin was emitted. Use an ultrasonic humidifier. The Aero Swiss Travel Ultrasonic Cool Mist Humidifier is incredible. It is small enough to fit in a jacket pocket, 1.3 pounds, because its water source comes from any convenience store, a plastic water bottle turned upside down. The ultrasonic technology uses high-frequency vibrations to generate a micro-fine cool mist, which is blown into the room where it evaporates into the air. This device is my go-to combination with the Go Light, especially after seeing how well it eliminates sinus problems while traveling. It also dramatically reduces facial wrinkles, which was an unexpected but pleasant side effect. The Aero Swiss humidifier comes with a transcontinental travel AC adapter and exchangeable plugs that can be used in both the United States and Europe. My only complaint? It emits a stylish but distracting blue glow, so you'll need an eye mask if you're light sensitive like I am. Use a Nightwave pulse light. The Nightwave was introduced to me by a good friend named Michael, who also has severe onset insomnia. During my testing, he started ranting and raving about this tiny device, a slow pulsing light the size of a cigarette pack, that helped him get to sleep in less than 7 minutes. Dr. James B. Moss, Vice Presidential Fellow and Professor of Psychology at Cornell University, is one of several researchers who have endorsed it. From the Nightwave website, Nightwave projects a soft blue light into your darkened bedroom. The luminance of the light slowly rises and falls. Lie with eyes open and synchronize your breathing with the blue wave as its movement becomes slower and slower. After a short time, the cycle Michael used was 7 minutes long, Nightwave shuts off and you roll over and fall asleep. Unlike sound machines, the soft light does not disturb others. It does work, but I found it less consistent than Michael did. His hit rate was near 100%. I now travel with the Nightwave, but use it as a supplement to the Go Light when needed. Given the cost differential, it will make sense for most people to experiment with the Nightwave, $40, before purchasing the Go Light, $350. Resort to the half military crawl position. This suggestion came from polling more than 70,000 Twitter followers for successful treatments for onset insomnia. Lie on your chest with your head on a pillow and turn to the right. Both arms should be straight by your sides, palms up. Now bring your right arm up until the top of your right elbow is bent at 90 degrees and your hand is close to your head. Alternative hand placement, the right hand is under your pillow and under your head. Next, bring your right knee out to that side until it is bent at approximately 90 degrees. This is a last resort that works for one simple reason. You can't move. It's like a self-imposed papoose, which the Inuits and other cultures have used to calm infants by immobilizing them. To toss and turn from the half-military crawl position, you have to first lift your entire body off the bed. Less fidgeting means faster sleep. On Longer and Better Life. This will be the shortest chapter on life extension ever written. Let it begin, as all good short chapters do, with a story of two monkeys, Canto and Owen. Housed at the University of Wisconsin, these two rhesus monkeys are as close to identical as possible, with one exception. Canto is on a diet. Specifically, his calories are restricted to 30% less than normal. He is part of a semi-fasting group of monkeys that has been on the 200 equivalent of Weight Watchers for two decades. Owen, in the feasting control group, is a stark contrast. He eats whatever the hell he wants. To date, in his 20-plus year experiment, 37% of the Eat, Drink, and Be Merry group have died due to causes related to old age. The calorie counting group has a much lower death rate, almost two-thirds lower. Cancel our reservations at the Cheesecake Factory. In fact, it's time to cancel dinner forever. Or, wait a second, is that really all there is to the story? Which brings me to low-cal Canto and high-cal Owen. Canto looks drawn, weary, ashen and miserable in his thinness. Mouth slightly agape, features pinched, eyes blank, his expression screaming, "Please, no, not another plateful of seeds." Well-fed Owen, by contrast, is a happy camper with a wry smile, every inch the laid-back simian, plump, eyes twinkling, full mouth relaxed, skin glowing, exuding wisdom as if he's just read Kierkegaard and concluded that life must be lived forward but can only be understood backward. It's the difference between the guy who got the marbleized ribeye and the guy who got the oh-so-lean filet. Or between the guy who got a Chateau Grand Ponte Saint-Emilion with his brie and the guy who got water. As Edgar notes in King Lear, ripeness is all. You don't get to ripeness by eating apple peel for breakfast. When life extension supplants life quality as a goal, you get the desolation of Canto the monkey. Living to 120 holds zero appeal for me. Canto looks like he's itching to be put out of his misery. We don't understand what the mind secretes. The process of aging remains full of enigma. But I'd bet on jovial Owen outliving wretched Canto. Laughter extends life. There's little of it in the low-cal world, and little doubt pudgy Owen will have the last laugh. If your goal is to live as long as possible, there is a long list, an endless list, of things to avoid. The good news is that life extension need not be complicated. For the gents, it may be as simple as blocking a few websites and curbing a little maleness. The pro-ejaculation lobby slipped up in 1992 when the New York Times broke the story. In Worm, at least, making sperm is found to shorten a male's life. See, Dr. Wayne Van Voorhees of the University of Arizona had allowed nematodes, also called roundworms, to kill themselves by copulating. In his research, nematodes prevented from mating lived an average of 11.1 days. Nematodes allowed to drop their drawers lived a scant 8.1 days. Never got to see the grandkids grow up. Never got to play golf at St. Andrews. It's a sad tale of weary scrotums, or whatever worms have as scrotums. The genes and biochemical processes nematodes use are the same as those that humans and other mammals use, elaborated Dr. Philip Anderson of the University of Wisconsin.
the Times connected the logical dots in their conclusion. Ceaseless sperm production takes its toll on a male, perhaps requiring the use of complex enzymes or biochemical processes that have harmful metabolic effects. The difference in lifespan between men and women, women live an average of 6 years longer, just may be linked to sperm production. Finally, no more ejaculating. It's like finding out that flossing is bad for you. No more tiring sex or arching wrists. Hassle removed. And you might live 37% longer. In the quest for longer life, it pays dividends to err on the side of caution, to avoid any unnecessary risks or unknowns. To live, after all, you don't need much. Air, water, gruel with some protein, and shelter will cover all the bases. One could therefore suggest no venturing outside the home, no driving or traveling, and certainly no exposure to other humans who could be sick with cat flu or diaper rash. Of course, this level of risk avoidance leads naturally to what we all want, a long-ass shitty life. But let's assume you're one of the few billion people who wants a degree of fun and freedom in life. The real question then becomes not how can I extend life at all costs, but rather how can I increase the length of my life without severely decreasing my quality of life? The most basic approach would be to eat, drink, and be merry and believe that a few more laughs and tasty calories will beat most lab theories in the long run. I believe this to be true. The second complementary approach, which can be followed right along with the first, is to consider therapies that are minimally inconvenient and that, based on the scientific literature, should work in humans. This short list of therapies should then be ethically filtered. Ethics can be nebulous, but here's an example. If you're a woman and want to buy cancer insurance, you could opt to have a full-term pregnancy before age 20. Some scientists believe it could be the most effective natural means of protecting against breast cancer due to the hormone HCG. Should you therefore have children before age 20? I would suggest that life extension is not a good enough reason, particularly since another life is involved. It's therefore omitted from our list. Separating the wheat from the chaff, we might consider four candidates that make the cut. Resveratrol, injections of the immunosuppressant drug rapamycin, Alzheimer's vaccines, stem cell therapies. These might just get you to 200 or beyond, especially if used in combination. And I'm avoiding them. But why? I believe, as do some scientists, that focusing on global therapies, drugs or treatments with broad molecular effects, without long-term human data, is barking up the wrong tree, a tree fraught with unpredictable side effects. Take resveratrol, for example, which is currently available over-the-counter. It is effective in extending lifespan in nearly all species tested, but it can also block or activate estrogen receptors. Could this affect other metabolic or hormonal feedback loops, perhaps disrupting fertility if taken routinely? It's impossible to say, which is precisely why I'll use resveratrol short-term at higher doses for endurance while tracking blood markers, but I won't use it indefinitely for life extension. Telomerase activators, like TA65, another example, are purported to extend our chromosomal countdown clocks called telomeres. TA65 can cost up to $15,000 per year. Is it possible that by amplifying cell replication, you increase the likelihood of dangerous cancerous growth? Perhaps. It's simply beyond our technology to guarantee one outcome or another, so I'm avoiding it. But if not in global therapies, where is the promised land? Until we can go to Walmart and get a RoboCop makeover with regenerative medicine, there are a few alternatives in a second short list. These are the protocols I am currently using. All of them are low cost, low tech, and low risk. Most of them also provide athletic or body composition benefits, even if their life extension effects are later debunked. Cycles of 5 to 10 grams of creatine monohydrate cost $20 a month. Creatine monohydrate, popular among power athletes since its commercialization in 1993, has recently become a candidate for minimizing or preventing the development of Alzheimer's,
Parkinson's, and Huntington's diseases. There is almost 20 years of published research involving human use of creatine monohydrate, and since my family has Alzheimer's and Parkinson's on both paternal and maternal sides, it is low-cost insurance. I'm ingesting 5 to 10 grams of creatine monohydrate powder per day for 2 consecutive weeks every 2 months. If you choose to use this protocol, I suggest tracking and trending hepatic enzymes, BUN, and all the usual blood testing suspects to ensure no kidney problems. Complications are rare, but an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Nowhere is this truer than in life extension. Intermittent fasting, IF, and protein cycling. Cost, free. What if poor, hungry Kanto only needed to fast on occasion to extend his life? Constant caloric deprivation isn't without risks after all. The decline in sex hormone production alone can cause amenorrhea, cessation of menstruation, and bone thinning, among other problems. It turns out that you can mimic, even exceed, the supposed life-extending effects of caloric restriction with intermittent fasting, IF. This can be true even if you consume twice as many calories as normal during your on days, resulting in no total decrease in weekly calories. There are several popular versions of IF and semi-IF protocols among experimental subcultures. Fast 5. Fast for 19 hours beginning at bedtime, followed by 5 hours of eating as much as necessary to satisfy hunger. This is popular for moderate weight loss, which typically appears starting in the third week and averages 1 pound of loss per week thereafter. Some research suggests IF confers the same life extension benefits as caloric restriction only when calories are consumed during daylight hours. This would, if accurate, make the Fast 5 better for fat loss than longevity. ADCR. Alternate day caloric restriction, ADCR, which requires that calories be cut 50 to 80% every other day, has been shown to improve insulin sensitivity, autoimmune disease, and even asthma after just 2 weeks. Protein cycling. Dr. Ron Mignery, author of The Protein Cycling Diet, suggests that even a single day per week of restricting protein to no more than 5% of total maintenance calories can produce effects similar to extended caloric restriction. If the mechanism of IF or CR is triggering a genetic self-preservation response, protein cycling makes sense. There are no essential dietary carbohydrates. Simply reducing calories, or carbs, wouldn't necessarily qualify as a biological emergency. On the other hand, even brief absences of essential amino acids like lysine might be enough to flip the switch. The switch, in our context, is triggering a process of cellular housekeeping, the purpose of which, in Dr. Mignery's words, to clear the cell of degraded and aggregated proteins that are not being handled by other recycling mechanisms of the cell. In principle, if you clear the junk out faster than it builds up, you postpone or reverse aging. I'm currently experimenting with both 18-hour and one-day protein cycling, which I believe, and it's pure conjecture, can also increase subsequent protein synthesis during overfeeding. For muscular growth phases, I have used the 18-hour protein cycling once per week precisely for this reason, usually ending between noon and 2 p.m. on my Saturday cheat day. Here's a sample menu for 1 day of less than 5% protein, adapted from Dr. Mignery. It is distinctively non-slow carb. Once you've cried a tear of dietary misery, I'll tell you what to do. Miscellaneous breakfast. Breakfast can include wheat-based, lysine-deficient products, such as toast, muffins, or bagels, provided that wheat is the only substantial source of protein and its calories are heavily diluted with calories from non-protein sources, butter, sugar, juice, fruit, etc. Toast with mushrooms, onions, and gravy. You can thicken the fat or drippings from meat with starch to make a gravy and drizzle it over the toast, mushrooms, and onions. Spinach with vinegar. Microwaved frozen spinach, less than 2 cups, can be flavored with any kind of vinegar for a near protein-free dish with the warmth and chew of meat. Meat substitutes. A microwaved slice of eggplant can fill a sandwich and give something of the shape and texture of a lunch meat. Black olives can also provide something of the texture of meat without the protein. Bean substitutes. Beans and peas are fairly high in protein and cannot be eaten in the restriction phase of protein cycling. But you can substitute spheres of cassava starch called tapioca pearls. They are a staple of tropical cuisine and are available in a wide range of sizes and colors. You may be familiar with them if you have ever had bubble tea. What I do? First, I drizzle fat gravy over a bowl of tapioca pearls. Kidding. I fast following an early Friday dinner, 6 p.m., and then around 10 a.m. the next morning, 16 hours later, I eat 1 cup spinach with vinegar and spices, 1 slice of sourdough toast with lots of butter, and enjoy it all with a large glass of grapefruit juice. Delish. Sometime afternoon, I'll then head off to eat my usual chocolate croissants and continue cheat day as a binge monster. The Lost Art of Bleeding. Cost? Free. Thought bloodletting went out of fashion around the time of the Salem witch trials? Not entirely. I'm betting on a major resurgence. It all has to do with excess iron. More than estrogen, it's thought to partially explain why postmenopausal, but not premenopausal, women have a similar incidence of heart attack to men. I've donated blood since 2001 to be on the safe side. I'm not alone. The New England Centenarian Study, conducted by Boston University's School of Medicine, is the world's largest and most comprehensive ongoing study of centenarians, people who live past 100. Dr. Tom Pearls, director of the study and an associate professor of medicine, gives blood every 8 weeks to mimic the loss of iron due to menstruation, which he believes will increase his longevity. Iron is a critical factor in our cells' ability to produce those nasty molecules called free radicals that play an important role in aging. It may be as simple as having less iron in your body. There is ample evidence that iron reduction through phlebotomy, bloodletting, can not only improve insulin sensitivity, but also reduce cancer-specific and all-cause deaths. High iron stores have been correlated to an increased number of heart attacks in otherwise symptom-free males. And blood donation has conversely been correlated to a decrease in cardiovascular incidence. Doctors Michael and Mary Danides suggest aiming for blood ferritin levels of 50 mg per dL, which, if your levels aren't over 400, can usually be achieved with 1 to 4 whole blood donations spread 2 months apart. No leeches required. If you'd like to increase the removal of pesticides and other environmental toxins that are normally stored in fat, you can fine-tune in 2 ways. Schedule to donate a double portion of plasma and drink a cup of caffeinated coffee about 60 minutes before going to the center. Donated blood will always contain such toxins, so you're not being a bad citizen by temporarily increasing their excretion. Though some scientists argue that iron depletion is necessary for full cardiac benefits, I see no harm in acting on the positive implications of dozens of other studies. Consensus won't come anytime soon, and even if you don't extend your own life, you might save someone else's. The Danish writer Hans Christian Andersen, beloved for his fairy tales, including The Little Mermaid and The Emperor's New Clothes, perhaps put it best. Just living is not enough. One must have sunshine, freedom, and a little flower. Extending life at the expense of quality of life makes little sense. It's easier, and lazier, to focus on subtraction and avoidance. But a life of constant denial is not a life of freedom. The greatest rewards come from a good life, not just a long life. This probably includes a bit of red wine and a few cheesecakes. Perhaps even an ejaculation or two. Closing thoughts. Running an ultramarathon can't be good for you. I can't imagine how it's possibly good for your body, I said. I wasn't biting on endurance. Running wasn't my thing, and it never had been. Brian McKenzie laughed. Good for you physically? No, but you'll recover. And I assure you, if you run 50K or 100 miles, when you finish, you won't be the same person who started. I thought for a minute, and that's when I bit. I'd seen a strange ripple effect dozens of times in the world of strength, but for some reason I'd never connected the dots with endurance. Perhaps just as you haven't connected the dots with some subjects in this audiobook. After all, in a knowledge economy, what's the value of deadlifting more or losing 2% body fat?
In a word, transfer. My father lost 70-plus pounds of fat in 10 months and tripled his strength in almost all lifts. During his annual checkup, his doctor declared that he might live forever. The physical changes were incredible, but the curious side effects of the program were the strongest incentives to continue. As my dad explained, "It's very odd. I used to feel like the invisible man, but now people more readily ask my opinion and take me more seriously. I went from not being noticed to being noticed." Quite apart from the aesthetic and performance benefit, there's a huge social benefit. I lost my invisibility. Also, after losing 50 or 60 pounds and doing what you once thought impossible, you start to see other impossibilities, doubling income in 12 months or whatever, as possibilities. This audiobook is intended to make you a better all-around human. It's also intended to make you a role model for those around you. Your body, your temple of performance and appearance, is almost always within your control. This is rare in life, perhaps unique. Focusing on some measurable element of your physical nature prevents you from becoming a Dow Joneser, someone whose self-worth is dependent on things largely outside of their control. Job not going well, company having issues, some idiot making life difficult. If you add 10 laps to your swimming, or if you cut 5 seconds off your best mile time, it can still be a great week. Controlling your body puts you in life's driver's seat. Becoming the best version of yourself, doing what other people consider impossible, doesn't take much time. Nor does it take much money. It just takes a willingness to test drive the uncommon. To incorporate changes so small that you'll forget you've made them after 3 weeks. Refuse to accept partial completeness. Take the next step. Uncap a pen and take an inventory of all the things in the physical realm that you've resigned yourself to being poor at. Now ask, if you couldn't fail, what would you want to be exceptional at? Circle these alternate realities. This list, circles staring back at you, gives you a blueprint for not just a new body, but an entirely new life. I'm excited to see what you become. This is Zach McLarty. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The 4-Hour Body, The Secrets and Science of Rapid Body Transformation by Tim Ferriss. This program was directed by Danny Campbell. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Abridgment by John McElroy. Text copyright 2010 by Tim Ferriss. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.